This is Kelly Krager conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Victor Berry. Today is 30 March 2016. I am in Lubbock, Texas on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Mr. Berry is joining me by telephone from his home in Cranford, New Jersey. That is correct, Cranford, right?
That is correct.
Okay, great. To begin this interview, Vic, I'd like to get some background and biographical information from you, if I could. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
Sure. I was born in Clinton, Oklahoma, in April of 1944, where my father was stationed in the Navy as a lieutenant who was an instructor at an avionics school. They had moved. Oklahoma's a strange place for the Navy. They had been at Galveston, but the flying weather was so bad, they moved inland.
Mm-hmm. And what was your father's name?
Victor Berry as well.
Okay, so you're a junior then?
I'm an Alexander.
Okay, all right, not quite junior.
Nope.
What about your mother? What was her name?
Her name was Eleanor Waglum. She was born in New York. Her father was a medical researcher at Columbia and a resident at Columbia Presbyterian. And she met my father while at Barnard, and he was at Columbia.
I see. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
I have one brother, Paul, who is 4 years younger than I am, and he lives in Denver, Colorado.
Okay. Well, tell me about your parents. What did they do for a living?
Well, my father worked first for RCA Radio before the war, and then after the war went back to work for them with NBC Television. He was a technical director, set up the first two UHF transmitters in the United States. And at the end of his career won an Emmy for his coverage of a number of Olympics.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
My mother was a housewife. Late, after my brother and I were much older, she went to work for a while as a medical tech at Columbia Medical. Another one of the universities in New York.
Okay. I assume you didn't grow up in Oklahoma then, by the sounds of your parents'
no,
positions. Where did you grow up?
I grew up, my father's work quickly took him to first to Connecticut and then to New York. So I grew up in suburbs around New York City. My father worked most of his career in or out of Radio City in New York.
Okay. So tell me about growing up here on the East Coast in the shadows of New York City, if you would. What kind of childhood was that like?
Well, it seemed like an ideal childhood, as I guess most people's do. I grew up in suburban neighborhoods with really very little connection with the city, other than the fact that my father got on a bus every day to go to work there. But, you know, I grew up in the post-World War II suburban development, so grassy lawns, lots of activities. We lived most of my time in Fairlawn, New Jersey, in a section called Radburn, which was the first planned community. It was started in the late 20s. Bad timing. It stepped right into the Depression, mm-hmm. and wound up being owned by an insurance company for a while. But it had a complete year-round sports and activities for children based on a nominal fee assessed on the homeowner. I later worked for them as a lifeguard and during my summers, and we would have visitors from all over the country wishing to set up the same kind of arrangement.
So were you pretty active as a kid in sports and outdoor activities and things like that?
I was very, well, I think all kids were active then. That was a time when you after breakfast, you got on your bicycle with your peanut butter and jelly sandwich and your Cub Scout canteen, and Mom said, be home at 6 for dinner.
Right.
And so, very different from today's, where kids seem to have to be transported everywhere by automobile, and every activity has to be overseen by adults and have professional training. In the suburban areas I grew up in, there, every area had what was known as the lot or the woods,
mm-hmm.
developed area that, you know, the the Village of Suburban Housing hadn't descended on yet, and most of our time was spent, you know, you'd go out to the sand lot or whatever, see how many people you had, and if you had eight people, you made rules for baseball that could be played by two teams of four.
Sure.
Never needed or really wanted an adult present.
Right, I can certainly understand that, relate to that. Different times, of course.
Yep.
Very much different times. Well, what about schooling? Where did you go to school, and what were you interested in?
Well, I went to school really from third grade on in the Fairlawn school system. In high school, I became interested. I never was a great athlete, which was a great disappointment. My father was a brilliant athlete. He had set records in swimming in the New York Y system, that one of them stood for over 20 years. And he'd co-captained the Columbia swimming team. He had boxed. He'd been on the rifle team. I was just a mediocre athlete. But I did run track in high school, and we ran in the first ever 4-mile relay for high school boys.
Hmm.
And we took second place. Every one of us ran miles in the 4-minute range. So.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah. Mine had a lot of seconds tacked on after the four. But so I was, you know, typical kid, I guess, interested in girls. Joined a couple of clubs, chemistry club and a few others, but that was about it.
Mm-hmm. Were you a very good student?
I was actually a rotten student up till my senior year. I'd been sort of a class clown through grade school and junior high school. Early in high school, I was infatuated with a young lady and really had no plans to go to college. My parents, as a last desperate move, sent me on my junior year on a tour abroad conducted by my French teacher. And suddenly I found myself surrounded by very bright kids all planning to go to college who I thought were really terrific people and very interested, and came back and announced to the girl we were breaking up, put a full press on my senior year, and went from a mediocre student to a straight-A student with 1,200 SATs.
So that really kind of put the bug in your ear, I guess.
Oh, it sure did.
About a more education, more opportunities, seeing the world, things like that, I guess.
And I've returned to school two or three times since college graduation for further degrees.
Hmm. Oh, very good, very good. A lifelong kind of thing,
yeah.
There, I guess. Sure. Well, tell me about growing up in the 40s and 50s. I mean, this is a time of the Eisenhower era, if you will, but also the time of the Cold War. What do you remember about the Cold War? How did that, or did it, impact your life?
Certainly I can remember duck and cover in the classrooms and getting under your desk or going out in the hall to behind the steel wall lockers to, you know, in case of a nuclear attack. So that was a little scary, but, you just took it as the way things were. I think the biggest thing I remember, and it really didn't occur to me till later on, was that I grew up in a suburban New Jersey neighborhood where we had one African American family.
Hmm.
And I remember the kids in high school, the Waddy kids, were always absolutely terrific students, participated in sports and band. And years later, it wasn't 2 years later, I remembered how difficult it must have been for them, because they never went to any of the proms or anything, and certainly there was no cross-racial dating then, so it must have been a very lonely existence for them. But at the time, I never thought about it.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, and this comes up from time to time, you know, when we talk to folks who grew up during this era. We oftentimes think about the South being segregated, which obviously it was, and variety of problems there. But oftentimes in the North, these kind of things were there as well. Did you see any sort of purposeful discrimination toward these folks, or was it pretty open?
Well, let me, it was, It was not direct and visible, other than the fact that it was, I'm sure that realtors steered people away from housing in these communities.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I knew as a white kid that if ever I was to have trouble and the police were there and the other person was black, that I was going to be the one who was going to come out on top. You mentioned the South. I went to school in Virginia. My first wife was from Richmond. And I know when I arrived and expressed concern about things I saw there, the Southerners were quick to point out to me that, you know, my Yankee liberalism was all well and good, but they lived in communities where there are large numbers of blacks. I grew up, I was in one that had one family out of a population of 20,000, so, you know, who was I to instruct them?
Mm-hmm. Certainly a difficult and complicated complicated issue and complicated time with race issues in the 50s.
And it continued, I guess we'll get to this later, but it continued in the service in Vietnam.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's definitely something that I want to talk to you about once we get to that point, for sure. All right, well, you mentioned that education kind of opened your eyes,
yes.
That you were much more interested in better grades and mm-hmm. Kind of a future.
Yeah, let me mention, I had two, I think, outstanding teachers my senior year that really left an impression. I guess the school realized I was bright if underachieving up until then, because I was put in both the first PSSC physics class taught and also in an advanced history class.
Hmm.
Our history teacher was Alan Bookbinder, was a doctoral candidate at Harvard in history, who was teaching as he worked on his dissertation. And he the first day there, took a look at our textbooks and said, this is a bunch of neutered nonsense. He said, you're all going to get a subscription to the New York Times, and we're going to talk about how government really works.
Mm-hmm.
But that was interesting.
Yeah.
And the PSSC physics teacher had just come back from Mr. Woodruff from 2 years with the Coastal and Geodetic Survey in Antarctica, and he talked about and introduced us how science was actually done. And I thought, wow, this is the first time I've had somebody who actually does what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
This guy was so involved with us and what he did. We had a student who was living with a family from Argentina who was accepted to Caltech and didn't have the money for tuition. And Mr. Woodruff helped finance his first year on a teacher's salary.
Is that right?
Yeah, so, you know. Those two people just stand out from my high school experience.
Yeah, that's quite a commitment from someone.
Sure is.
Hmm. So, do you know that college will be in your future? Is this something that you're striving for?
Say that again?
College. College something that you're striving for at this point?
Yes, in my senior year, I just put on a full court press.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, was accepted at William & Mary, put on a wait list at UVA, accepted at Rutgers, and at Fairleigh Dickinson.
Oh, wow, that's some pretty heavyweights right there. Well, when did you graduate from high school?
I graduated in 1962.
Okay, 1962, and that's a good departure point here. Of course, Kennedy is elected in 1960, and Kennedy meant a lot of things to a lot of different folks in a lot of different ways. And kind of a touchstone of the Vietnam generation. What did you think about Kennedy?
My parents were very strong Republicans, so initially I didn't think a great deal of him. As time went on, in my senior year in high school and into college, and I vividly remember exactly where I was and what I was doing when he was assassinated, I came to think very highly of him, and you know, so it kind of felt like I was personally accepting his challenge to our generation.
Mm-hmm. What about his administration, his policies? What did you think about that?
By and large, I thought very positively of them. I think subsequently I've read that there was a great deal of massaging, that he may not have been nearly as good a president as we felt he was at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he's certainly the one who got us involved in Vietnam.
Right, right.
But, you know, largely positive.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you remember very clearly where you were when you received mm-hmm. word of the assassination. Where were you?
Well, I got involved in folk music at school. I happened to be, we had local hoot nannies at the college, and there was a young woman I sang with, and she and I were sitting out on the steps of her dorm rehearsing when somebody came by and told us. And I can just remember, we just couldn't believe it. Side note, there was a television show then called ABC Hootenanny,
mm-hmm.
And they had approached the college about doing some shows there. They would have been during exam reading period, and the university said, no, we don't want them distracted during this. When a group of us became aware of this, we went out at the head of the Sunken Garden and held a protest singing. Editor of the college paper was there writing a story, taking pictures, and he later told us he had us on the AP wire when all of a sudden a stop hold came from Dallas, and it was Kennedy's assassination.
What kind of impact do you think the Kennedy assassination had on you, the community, and the country in general?
Well, I don't think that I had known, other than the assassination attempt on Truman, that there ever had been a prior, other than Lincoln, obviously,
mm-hmm.
Presidential assassination, and we were just overwhelmed. It just didn't seem to be like something that could possibly happen. And so I said we all felt sort of just a deep sense of mourning.
You graduate in 62.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you wind up going to college?
College of William & Mary.
You went to William & Mary. All right. Tell me about your time there at William & Mary. What was that like for you? What are you studying? What are you hoping to do?
Well, I arrived planning on a career in foreign service.
Hmm. Well, let me ask you, how did that bug get put in your ear?
I think that was my mother. She was also the one who encouraged me to apply to Virginia schools.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got to say that with an SAT of 1,200, I was probably on the bottom half of the curve
mm-hmm.
for students there. They were just an incredibly smart group of people. And I knocked myself out my first year trying to perform well. So in fact, I still remember I was on the debate team early in my first year. And my debate partner was a kid who had gone to Brown's prep school. And I would trudge home at the end of the day with 400 pages of reading to do for my classes. And I would try and read every damn last page. And I'd be up to 2, 3 in the morning. And Don finally took me aside and he said, you know, kid, you're not going to make it if you do this. He said, didn't anybody ever teach you how to read a professor? Said no. He said, look, most of them teach whatever they did their dissertation on. Watch him carefully, see what he emphasizes, read that part, and the hell with the rest of it unless you have time. And because of him, I think I survived.
So if you have a career in mind with the Foreign Service,
yeah,
what was your major area of study? What were you focusing on?
Oh, I bounced all around. I went from that to French to economics and finally settled on English literature as a not too difficult path to a bachelor's degree.
Hmm.
I can't say that I was a highly motivated or career-focused student at that point.
Yeah. So you went with down a track that pays you all kinds of great salaries.
Yeah, right.
With English literature. Well, what did you hope to do? You graduate, I guess, 4 years later, so this would have been, 66, I guess.
Well,
what did you hope to do?
Well, I wanted employment. I had a college girlfriend that I wanted to marry. Fortunately, I worked as a waiter in one of the restaurants in Williamsburg at a time when a lot of very bright people were being attracted to Atlanta. And one of them said, you know, you really ought to look into IBM. So I contacted them. I went up to Patterson. I took, it seemed like 2 full days of interviewing and tests. At the end, they expressed interest in hiring me on graduation. So I was going to go to work in some kind of administrative capacity with them. What happened, though, is that as I got closer to graduation and Vietnam was heating up, it became pretty clear that if I went out in the world, I could have my grown-up life interrupted by the draft.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked IBM if they would hold that position for me if I did my military service first. They said yes. So on graduation, I enlisted.
You mentioned Vietnam and the draft, of course. How aware were you of what was going on over in Southeast Asia?
Well, pretty aware for actually a number of reasons. I want to drop back to a junior high school class I had. It was an art class. It had a most unusual woman who taught it in that, and so now we're talking 1959 or so, would read from the New York Times to us before at the beginning of class, and she was talking about what was going on in Laos and Cambodia, and she said, you better pay attention to this. It's going to impact you. Women marry required ROTC for the first 2 years of all male students, so I went through 2 years of ROTC. One of our captains had just returned from Vietnam, so he told us about it. I was one of these students that I didn't read what was assigned. I would go to the bookshop and just leaf through and find something, and one of the things I found was a book by Henry Kissinger, which was discussing really what would become the basis of the 11th Air Assault Division, which later became the 1st CAV, and it was propounding that we needed an anti-guerrilla capability, otherwise the Soviets would pick us apart around the world, as they were in Africa at the time, saying, you want a nuclear war over this, America? So I was aware that all this stuff was noodling around in the background, and I'm firmly convinced that we became involved in Vietnam in part as a way to test the theory of the 1st CAV and Air Mobile to see if we really had, after studying what the Brits had done in World War II with guerrilla warfare, if we had come up with a viable answer to guerrilla warfare.
Yeah.
So, long story short, I was aware that what was going on.
So, 66, like you say, things are beginning to ramp up over there in Vietnam. The American commitment is beyond the advisory capacity. We have ground troops, we have B-52s, we have the whole shooting match.
Right, the 173rd's in there, the Marines are in there.
Absolutely.
Infantry's going over.
What did you think about American involvement at the time? Was this something that you thought, this is where we need to be, this is what we need to be doing?
Both my French professors and my father, who I mentioned when we chatted before, had fled Russia in 1917. He'd grown up in France part of his life. All advised me that the United States had little awareness or experience in that area, that the French had been there for over 100 years, had gotten roundly trounced, and we were making a terrible mistake if we thought we were going to do any better with no background in the area. So, no, I was against our involvement.
Yeah. But regardless of where the United States was involved, you have military service looming. You have graduated from college. The exemption wouldn't be there for you. And it looks like you're trying to take some proactive steps here by enlisting. Another one of the benefits of enlisting rather than being drafted is that perhaps you would have a little bit more leeway in where you wanted to go and what you wanted to do. Did you find that to be the case?
Well, I did, but I chose badly. My father, they mentioned, was a naval officer in World War II, said, son, if you're going into the military, you want to go in as an officer. That's the only way to do your service. So I guess a couple of months before graduation, I started going to recruiting offices to look into officer programs. The Navy looked at English literature and said, sorry, son, we have no interest in you. The Air Force said, well, you have 20/20 vision. We'd consider you as a pilot, but you're going to owe us 6 years active duty at the end of that. The Army, bless them, said, oh, son, we'd be happy to offer you any of our three schools, infantry, armor, or artillery. We would recommend Benning Infantry because since it's the least expensive training, it's the easiest to get out of after commissioning. So I went in under what was called the College Op Program, bound for Benning. The program was 2 years active service after commissioning or completion of the 2 years if you didn't complete OCS. So I went in, all my training is infantry, and somewhere in my advanced infantry training, I decided I made a mistake, and I gave up my Benning slot.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. So that's how a bright kid who could have chosen better wound up as an infantryman.
Where did you wind up doing your boot camp, basic training?
I did both basic and AIT at Fort Jackson, South Carolina.
Well, that's not the least bit like suburban New Jersey. Tell me about your time at Fort Jackson.
Well, it was hot and humid because it was July, August, September, October in Columbia, South Carolina. When I arrived at boot camp and was started to undergo harassment by the drill sergeants, it occurred to me that there seemed to be a combination of two things I had encountered before. One was fraternity hazing, and the other was YMCA summer camp. And if I deployed the skills I learned at the two, somehow I just might survive this.
Tell me about your routine there at in basic. What was that like for you?
Well, it was up at 5:30, eat, go out and march, fire your rifle, march some more. I learned a very important lesson early on. I had been, a half miler in high school and was a very good runner. And at the end of a march, I guess probably about our third or fourth week there, the drill sergeant turned to me and said, well, what do you think of that, Private Barry? He just called us to stop to rest. And I said, well, frankly, drill sergeant, I don't think it was all that difficult.
Uh-oh.
At which point he called the company to attention, said, Private Barry has requested that we march another 2 miles. And I never made that mistake again. After that was, oh, yes, sir, I don't know how I possibly survived this.
You made some friends there immediately, didn't you?
Yes, they made it quite clear that they expected that never to happen again.
In addition to the physical aspects of it, which are intense, and they're intense for a reason, what about the mental aspect of it? Because that's equally as important, if not more.
Well, it certainly was challenging. I mean, I had, as an upper middle class kid, I had never been treated that way. It was a demeaning experience in a lot of ways. I mean, they quite literally broke us down psychologically in the first few weeks. Wasn't until years later in a doctoral program in clinical psychology I realized that I'd been through one of the best operant conditioning programs that had ever been designed. it was intense. I was, you know, separated from my college sweetheart with very little chance of getting any leave, at least during basic. So it was was intense.
Mm-hmm. But you survived basically unscathed, I guess.
Yeah, I did. I took it very seriously. I knew where we were likely to go, so I listened and tried my darndest to master every skill that they were, presenting to us, because I thought my life might well depend on it.
So you figured that Vietnam could easily be in your future then, given what was going on?
Yes.
Yeah. So after basic, you stay there at Fort Jackson for AIT.
Right.
Tell me about AIT. How is it different from boot camp, and what were your experiences there?
Well, it's different in a couple of ways. One was that now the training was very focused. We were treated a little bit better. There was far less harassment. It was to master the skill of the various weapons and small unit maneuvers. And what we were likely to do, you know, as a member of an infantry squad or platoon. And we also, we happened to be billeted in a brand new three-story barracks. It was brick barracks that was centrally air conditioned. It was more like a college dorm, only you had 40 roommates instead of one. That had a negative in that we were forever getting people down to inspect it, which meant we missed a lot of weekend passes polishing the floors with paste wax that we had to buy ourselves to get ready for the the people that review the billet. But I was largely impressed with the training I got. Did my very best to master it. Was absolutely crestfallen when I missed expert rifleman by 1 point.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Well, tell me about the weapons training there. What sort of weapons are you?
We were the last cycle to go through with the M14. Mm-hmm. So I was trained on the M14, the M60 machine gun, and the M79 grenade launcher. We had familiarization with the .45 caliber pistol, the M250 caliber machine gun, and the 3.5-inch rocket launcher. So, pretty extensive.
Mm-hmm.
I was particularly good with the M60, which I thought was just a superb weapon.
AIT is over.
Yep.
You are fully trained. The Army's going to have plans for you. You're an infantryman.
Well, this is what happened. I gave up my slot at Benning probably about a month before the end of AIT. And that threw a monkey wrench into the flow of orders. I mean, there were three groups of people in my AIT unit. There was a group of enlistees or draftees who were going to heavy weapons platoon. So they did most of their training separate from us. They were being trained on mortar and the recoilless rifle. The other two groups, who were all getting light weapons infantry training, one group was a bunch of Detroit National Guardsmen doing their 4 months or whatever of active training. NCOs didn't like them very much. And the rest of us were people who were going to one of the three combat arms, OCSs, under the college op program.
Mm-hmm.
And the NCOs took particular delight with us because it was going to be the last chance to harass us before we became officers. Anyway, so we come to the end of that training period. The heavy weapons folks get orders for their assignments to various units. The OCS folks go off to OCS. I have no orders. So they kept me around until orders appeared, which took about 6 weeks, made me an acting drill corporal, and I was assigned to the cadre to train the next group of AIT students.
Now, that's really a kind of a different kind of approach to things. Six weeks is a long time.
Yeah, for orders to catch up.
Yeah, and perhaps they just didn't know for sure what they were going to do with you.
Well, they didn't.
Yeah. You're a drill corporal.
Yeah.
So now you get the chance to inflict some of that damage on other unsuspecting souls. And I didn't know this was part of your experience. Tell me about being a member of the drill cadre.
Well, first off, I was treated like a person, which was a great revelation. You know, nobody barked at me anymore. The trainees looked up to me. I did the best I could to train them. I did nothing to try and harass them. And I actually, once I was in Vietnam, met a couple of the guys I had trained.
And this lasts for 6 weeks, you say?
Yep.
And the whole time, of course, you, I guess, are probably assuming that the orders to Vietnam will eventually work their way over.
Well, yeah, and actually, just as a segue, orders did come down initially, and they were to go to Mannheim, Germany.
Jackpot.
Yeah. My college sweetheart, who is now my wife, and I were thrilled because we had both worked in France one summer while we were in college. Mannheim was close to the French border, so we were just absolutely thrilled. The day she came to pick me up, the day before she came to pick me up, the orders changed. And the folks giving to me said, can't tell you exactly where you're going, but you're drawing green underwear and stuff. This is, and that's an Asian APO. This is not good. So on all the drive home from Columbia to Richmond, I played along with my wife as we talked about all the things we were going to do in Germany and France, knowing full well that wasn't where I was going, but I didn't want to break it to her while we were still in the car. So it was a very long ride.
When did you finally break the news to her?
As soon as we got to our apartment.
Yeah. That must have been tough.
It was tough, and we obviously both were very frightened.
Mm-hmm. So when did the orders finally arrive? You know you're going to Vietnam.
Well, they did that just before I cleared.
That was them, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
But they were just to what turned out to be 90th Replacement Battalion.
Sure, sure.
They weren't for any particular unit.
All right, and what is the time frame we're looking at here?
That's the beginning of December. So I had a leave. I think it was either 2 or 4 weeks before I left. During that period of time, she talked me into impregnating her, which I told her I thought was a stupid idea, because if I was killed there, the last thing she needed to do is be a single mom.
Mm-hmm.
And she insisted that if she was going to lose me, that she wanted something of me left behind. And I eventually acceded.
You mentioned that you were certainly concerned, as was your wife or future mm-hmm. wife. The war's going on over there. You've been
mm-hmm.
through training. You've probably, I assume, run into some folks who have who've been to Vietnam.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Let me just say that for the first 6 weeks of my AIT, all the folks who were training us were, all the drill sergeants, were Korean and World War II veterans. And they were very honest with us that they were teaching us out of a manual
mm-hmm.
with no personal experience. They said, towards the end of your training, though, we're going to get some folks back from there. And he said, you listen very carefully to them, because they know what they're talking about. And most of these were, you know, fairly junior people. They were E4s and E5s who were coming back from the 1st Cav and the 1st Infantry Division and the 25th. No, not the 25th. No, 1st Cav and 1st Infantry. And we did listen very carefully to them. But I thought the honesty of our training cadre was very refreshing.
Mm-hmm.
They said, you know, there is a difference between teaching what you just learned out of a book and having experienced something. And that's certainly something I made clear to the guys I was training as a drill corporal, was I'm teaching you what they taught me,
mm-hmm.
but I cannot tell you that I'm teaching from personal experience.
What about the guys who had been to Vietnam? What were they telling you guys?
They were telling us that we were in for a world of hurt.
Hmm.
You know, they were proud of their units, they were proud of their service, but they said, you know, this is not not pretty.
Was there anything specific, whether it's talking about booby traps or talking about, you know, jungle conditions or how tactics will change in that kind of environment?
About that, and actually they tried, they did their best in their training. I mean, we had, you know, we trained in assaulting Vietnamese villages. We were showed what punchy stakes looked like. Later in our training, they actually gave us BB guns and had us do instinctive firing. Because they realized that, you know, we were being trained with the M14 on the model of the revolutionary soldier, you know, the individual who sights a target 100 yards, 200 yards away and takes careful aim. And the people coming back said, this isn't how it is. It's that you, you know, normally can't see what's 30 feet in front of you, and you just have to immediately react to where the fire is coming from. And that's what they were telling us.
Yeah. Obviously, very valuable lessons that they're trying
yes.
to impart upon you there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. What about the political climate around the war? You mentioned that you were not buying into this particular war at this particular
right.
time in this particular area. But you're going to go anyway. Are you paying attention to what the politicians are saying, what the generals are saying, the nascent anti-war movement that is beginning to rise up? How aware were you of all of this kind of turmoil around the world?
I was certainly hearing what the politicians and the military senior leadership were saying and discounting a lot of it. I was not aware of the anti-war movement. I knew people who were anti-war like me in college, but I can't, you know, there were not, that I was aware of in 1966, any marches or anything of that sort. And so I think once I was in the military training, I just, you know, said, well, you know, I got to pay attention here and learn the best I can. So, you know, I very much hope I would not have to go.
Mm-hmm.
I very much thought that this was a mistake. But I knew my position in it and just figured I've got to quit myself the best I can.
And it must have been very difficult on your wife as well, I would think.
Yes, yeah.
What about your parents?
They really let me down on that one. After encouraging me, you know, to seek an officer billet when they found out that I had enlisted for infantry, they said, you do realize that our neighbor's son is a West Point graduate. And a major said, if you just relied on us to work through him, you probably could have gotten a cushy booth somewhere.
Hmm.
This was in direct conflict with all the stuff I'd heard for years about, and again, my father, I think, felt this as having arrived in this country, as having an obligation to the Republic, whose benefits you enjoyed. So I can't say they gave me a lot of support.
Mm-hmm. And it's one thing to believe this and move through it. It's another thing to, of course, have your child have to go through this. Perspective changes, of course.
Years later, my youngest daughter decided she wanted to go to work for one of the federal agencies and in law enforcement, and came back and said, you know, we're going to go down to Virginia and we're going to fire weapons and learn how to, you know, deal with perps. And I said, let me tell you, as someone who's been shot at and someone who's been wounded, said, this is not a lot of fun. This is not something I think you really want to do.
Yeah. Well, you're going to do it. You've got, 30 days leave or whatever it might have been. What do you do during that time?
Saw friends, listened to folk music, visited family. I have a photo somewhere of the two of us the day before I left, standing in front of our apartment in Richmond, trying to put on brave faces, but they are the most strained, unbrave-looking faces I've ever seen.
Hmm. But that's really interesting. Must be quite a photograph to look back at from time to time. Yeah. All right, Vic. The time comes around.
Yeah.
You're leaving.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me how you go from Richmond over to Southeast Asia.
Well, we went up to Travis Air Force Base, flying through Chicago on the way, dressed in our Class A summer uniforms, our khaki short sleeves, freezing to death because it's very cold in Chicago. And then we boarded the plane, and as an 11B, there were some other 11Bs there. We sort of paddled around together. Had one interesting experience on the way. We made several stops. One was in the Philippines to refuel. And as the plane's refueling, we're standing out there, and a couple of airmen come by in a Jeep. Said, "Hey, you guys, you got some time. Why don't you jump in the Jeep? We'll take you to the EM Club. You can have a couple of beers." So, hey, that's great. So we jump in the Jeep. We have a couple of beers or maybe a few more, lose track of time, and all of a sudden one of the people from the flight comes running in and says, "They're holding the plane for you. You guys are in real trouble." And we just looked at him and said, "Oh, what are you going to do? Send me to Vietnam as an infantry man?" "Oh, too late." So we got on the plane. There were no repercussions whatsoever. And next we landed at probably Benoit, and either Benoit or Tansanute, I forget which.
Mm-hmm.
And then bussed up to the 90th Replacement Battalion.
And when do you arrive in country? What is this, January 67?
Yeah, it's January 7, 1967. The routine there was there'd be a morning formation. The trucks from the infantry divisions would roll in one at a time. They'd call out names. You'd be directed to board the trucks. After a couple of days, we had figured out the routine that it was always the infantry divisions they called first, and they would repeat the same process in the afternoon. So after the infantry divisions were called and our names weren't called, we stopped listening. I think it was the third day we were there in the afternoon. All of a sudden, I heard my name called along with a couple of guys I'm standing with. And I turned to one of the guys and said, "I wasn't listening. What unit are they calling?" The guy said, "I kind of half heard it. It was the 11th something or other." I said, "It's probably the 11th Armored Cav."
Mm-hmm.
"Makes sense." So we went to the NCOIC and said, "Where is the truck we're supposed to get on?" He said, "Wait a minute, your transportation's coming." And a few minutes later, we heard a UE approaching. It sits down on a pad. He said, "Go over there." He said, "That's your transportation." And we learned we weren't going to the 11th Cav. We were going to the 11th Aviation Battalion. And we thought we had died and gone to heaven.
What did you know about the 11th Aviation?
Not a thing. But I knew it wasn't the infantry.
Right.
So they helicopter took us up to Phu Loi. What the 11th was in, I think it was March of 66. Army aviation existed in two forms. There was the 1st Cav had its own aviation and had sufficient aviation to support a division.
Mm-hmm.
All the rest of the Army aviation were individual units that were made available as needed to infantry divisions. In 66, they decided this wasn't a good way to do it, so they took all the aviation units that weren't part of an infantry division and put them under an umbrella organization called the 1st Aviation Brigade.
Mm-hmm.
And the 11th was part of 12th Group of the 1st Aviation Brigade. Where we were was one of four 1st Infantry Division bases in the area, and so the 11th's job was primarily to support the 1st Infantry Division. Although, you know, it got tasked out as needed. They supported the Arvins, the 25th, the 199th, even sent a unit up to the 173rd for the Battle of Dak Toh. And as I walked into personnel, life suddenly got better and better. The clerk going through my records saw that I was a college graduate and asked if I typed. Well, I'd taken a non-credit typing course in high school to prepare myself to be able to gin out term papers and in high school and college. So I said, yeah, in fact, I can type 40 words a minute. Of course, it was on a manual. And he said, oh, yeah, prove it. So I did. And then he said, I got one more question for you. I said, what? He said, do you play bridge? I said, yeah, I'm actually pretty good at it. He said, well, we got a couple of positions I can offer you. He said, we have a security platoon, because we're responsible for part of the base security,
mm-hmm.
Where you can go and you'll spend a year in bunkers defending the perimeter. He said, or I can offer you a position here in this office as a personnel specialist. I said, that sounds pretty good to me. I'll take that one.
Wow. You kind of fell into that.
I sure as hell did.
Hmm. Now, I wonder, could you describe Fuloy for me, both the physical layout and what's going on there?
Sure. Fuloy, it was an interesting base. It was just a single airstrip surrounded by a lot of ground. The airstrip had been built by the Japanese in World War II using American and Allied prisoners of war to build it. Okay, have a good time.
Thank you.
Bye. My wife's going to New York for the day, just saying goodbye. Anyway, so it was a single airstrip around which were two aviation battalions, ours and then a 1st Infantry Aviation Battalion. Across the field, we had an armored cavalry squadron of the 1st Infantry, which is the quarter cab, the 1st of the 4th Squadron. And then we had a maintenance unit down the field that did the really complex work on airframes,
mm-hmm.
stuff that was beyond the 67 N20s, the helicopter mechanics that were either mechanics in our unit or were crew chiefs. So that was it. It was a mid-sized base.
What about the activity there? What's going on? Who's coming in? Who's going out? What sort of operations are coming out of Fuloy?
We in the first Division's Aviation Battalion are constantly running either small missions or getting involved. I was there for Cedar Falls and Junction City, bigger operations. So it's constant aircraft coming in and out. Squadron, the 1st Squadron, 4th Cav going out in their M60s, M113 armored personnel carriers, and a small track vehicle called a Duster, which was a leftover anti-aircraft track from Korea that had twin 40-millimeter cannons on it that, when jets came, was no longer of any use as an anti-aircraft weapon, but the regular army had called it back from the National Guard when they needed a light track vehicle to break up hardened bunkers that were in terrain too boggy for an M60 to act in.
Mm-hmm.
So, a lot of noise, a lot of activity. At night, usually the perimeter would periodically be lit up.
Lit up by?
Incoming fire, outgoing mm-hmm. fire. So we were at the foot of what was called the Iron Triangle, which was an area northwest of Saigon where Highway 13 and the Saigon River split. It had been the head of Kazvin, where Head Kazvin headquarters had been since the French Indochina War. It was a hot area.
Tell me about coming into your unit. You mentioned that you got the job as a personnel specialist here. Tell me about the people you're working with, the hierarchy command that you're dealing with,
sure.
and your daily duties.
Well, the people, it's funny, the enlisted men I worked with in the personnel department and in the battalion headquarters were a collection of some, other than the Army-trained clerks, of very bright people who had either been infantrymen or helicopter crew chiefs or mechanics. Most of the infantrymen that were there because they had extended 6 months to get out of the infantry. The mechanics, two of the mechanics I knew or I worked with, one had been in for warrant officer flight training but had suffered a head injury in the pugil pit and was told he'd have to wait a year to go to warrant officer flight school because of the head injury. And he said, you know, nuts to that.
Right.
Another one was a helicopter crew chief who, after a couple of crashes, said, no more flying for me. Anyway, the Army, I guess, in its headquarters, and we were a headquarters of an aviation battalion of 1,800 people, needs bright people to do its administrative work. And most of us were college graduates, and although we hadn't been trained as clerks, the Army figured it needed bright people, and we could learn what we needed to learn OJT.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the guys I worked with. The battalion headquarters was I first started working out, and then they built a personnel building for us. Was it was headed by a full colonel. It had S1, 2, 3, 4 located there. All the commissioned officers in the headquarters also held appointments as pilots with one of the aviation units we had on the base. I guess the other thing I discovered that I just want to tell you about, I had never heard of a warrant officer before I got there.
Hmm.
And fully half our pilots were warrant officers.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned later why. I think at the time the Congress allowed 16,000 commissioned officers in the Army. I once added it up, and if every aviator in the 1st Aviation Brigade was a commissioned officer, it would have taken 12,000 commissioned officers. So the Army very quickly began using the warrant officer flight program to generate half the aviators they're going to need.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys are great. They were all 18 to 20 years old, just glorified kids. Daddy had just given them the biggest hot rod you've ever seen. And they didn't consider themselves officers. They considered themselves pilots.
Mm-hmm.
And they assessed everybody else, regardless of his rank, as to how good a pilot he was.
Yeah.
And they didn't waste any time harassing the enlisted men. All they wanted to be was helicopter drivers, and they were superb.
And like you say, the warrant officer program, of course, leads to a lot younger pilot cadre.
Yeah.
Which is probably good and bad, depending on how you look at it. But certainly a lot of fearless guys come through that warrant officer program.
Yeah.
And did an awful lot of good work throughout the course of the war. But you're not one of them, Vic. You're in personnel. Tell
yep.
me about your job.
Job was the best job you could possibly have. I was AOR clerk. And my job was to make sure that every junior enlisted man from E2 through E6 got orders to go to his next position at the end of his 12 months and had a ticket on a plane home.
Hmm.
I mean, you couldn't have asked for a job that you could feel better about.
Yeah. Your job basically is the hope and the future of the guys coming through.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I tell you, I replaced somebody who was an Army-trained clerk who was running stuff on the side, taking advantage of that. And that was something I would never have considered in my life, having, you know, been in the combat arms, been, by the grace of God, given a reprieve from it. The last thing in the world I could have ever considered was holding one of these guys hostage.
Hmm. Do you care to talk about what was going on there, or would you rather not?
Well, I'll I'll give you a couple of things I learned about later. There was a rumor that the guys who ran our ration breakdown, who drove the truck down to Saigon a couple of times a week to get our food, were selling some of it on the way back up to Fugloy. When I got back to the States and had my final assignment, I wound up in an apartment complex with one of these guys and asked him, was the rumor true? He said, oh, yeah. He said, I pocketed $20,000 while I was there. Now, as an E5 at that point with housing allowance and all that, I was making $350 a month. So you can imagine what $20,000 sounded like.
That is huge money, especially for the times.
Yeah.
The circumstances.
It was rumored, but I don't know if it's true, that the guy who we had a liaison shed at Tansanud Air Base, one of the guys there was actually selling M16s on the black market.
Hmm.
I can't confirm that, but knowing the guy, it's not inconceivable.
Yeah.
And I'll just give you one other thing, because I was actually bribed once, but I didn't realize it at the time. I was in the office working on some stuff, and an E6 came up. He's got an air cab patch on his right shoulder, and he's from one of our aviation units. He said, you know, specialist, I'm very concerned. He said, I'm supposed to go home in 3 days, and I don't have any orders. And I said, Sarge, that's absolutely wrong. They've got to be somewhere. I see you're with the cab. Who were you with? He told me. I said, look, you know, go about your business. We're going to radio up there. I said, I'm sure we're going to find your orders up there. And, we'll get them printed right up here, and we'll have them for you, and you'll be on your way. And I went back to doing something else, and he said, thank you, specialist. Do you like bourbon? And I said, well, I guess I like it as much as anybody else. So he comes back late in the day. We indeed have got his orders. We've gotten them printed up. I hand them to him, wish him well. At the end of the day, I get up, and I fall over a paper bag with a half gallon of bourbon in it. And I thought at the time, gee, this is terrible. You know, this is what career NCOs think, that nobody does anything unless there's a quid pro quo.
Yeah.
And it's the last thing in the world I would have done. But he was gone, so we drank the bourbon.
I would say that. I hope you didn't let that bourbon go to waste.
Well, but it's the only time I was ever bribed, and the only time I did something that could be, you know, anywhere near taking advantage of my position.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, again, from his perspective, that's probably the way that the world worked.
It did, yeah. There was a lot of that. I learned a lot of that in the military. There's a lot of side activity going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I wonder, you told me what your job is and mm-hmm. kind of given me a little insight here and there, and I don't want to get too technical or
sure.
tax your memory too much, but can you tell me what sort of processes that you would go through, you know, the process for dealing with someone's forms with their records for making sure they're going on a certain time. How would all of that, where would it come down from? How would it work?
Well, actually, one of the things I did there was develop a better and a streamlined one. People would process through when they came into the unit. You would then, you know, you would know when they arrived, so their DROS, their date of earliest return from overseas, was established. You had them fill out some paperwork, one of which was a dream sheet, you know, where would you like your next assignment to be. And there didn't seem to be a process then to make sure that you brought those persons' records up again when you had to do all these things. So I developed a process where I had a 3x5 card that I had drawn up with the information I needed, and as I processed the paperwork, I filled out the card with this information and then put them in month order so that I would never skip somebody who was supposed to go home. It worked very effectively. So once that was done, I was done with them pretty much, other than I would, you know, follow the morning reports, and if somebody was killed or sent to another unit, I would get rid of that card. I would fill out a form with people's dream sheet, where they wanted to go, This was before we had any computers, so I would fill it out in paper, and then, oh, probably 3-4 months before the person was supposed to go home, I would get the sheet out back with the people who are coming up, and with their declared dream location, which was done with a number. The funny thing is, out of the whole year I was there, two of them only came back wrong with the letter numbers reversed. One of them was mine.
You're kidding me.
No, instead of 24, which was Central Virginia, it became 42, which was Fort Riley, Kansas.
Huh.
And I corrected it, but that was what I had orders for when I derosed.
Well, they're considerably different places, so I bet you probably did want to change that.
And fortunately, I had been told by someone that the Army was very good about taking care of returning veterans, and I was an E-5 by then, so I went to the Pentagon, to OPO, and said, could you correct this, because I've got 6 months left, and it's going to cost you a lot of money to send me and my family to Kansas. I'm going to be unhappy. You're going to be unhappy, and then you have to pay to send us back to Virginia when it's all over. And they said yes, and they offered me 3 different postings in Virginia to choose from.
Oh, very nice.
All right. That was it. I would process, those records, take care of them, make sure that, each month approached, that I had given our headquarters, up at Long Bend, the list of the people who I was going to need tickets for. And it's kind of a little story there. I had been on the phone to them on a number of occasions, invited them down. They wanted no part of Fuloy. Seemed too dangerous for them.
Hmm.
One day I went to the personnel sergeant, and I said, Sergeant Getman, said, sometimes when I need something from these guys, a drop maybe for somebody who's had a family issue or something, he said, I'm just another voice at the end of the line. He said, would you give me a Saturday off, and I'll fly up there, and I can take my colleague on the other end of the line out for a couple of drinks, which he said, sure, sounds like a good idea. And I went up, and I befriended the guy on the other end of the line. The drinks were paid for by me, not the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, after that point, when I needed a favor for somebody, I never had any problem.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, there's different kinds of greasing the skids. And
there absolutely
you found a way there, yeah.
Yeah, and it was just face-to-face, and you get to know the person who you're talking to. And I said, I told him of this guy. I said, I will never ask for a drop unless there's a serious problem.
Mm-hmm.
I want you to know that if I do ask, it's somebody who desperately needs it.
Yeah. Tell me about your daily life, your pace of life. What would you be doing, from when you get up in the morning?
Sure.
Take me through your day.
It was certainly a fairly comfortable life. First off, we slept in wooden billets, 4 men to a room, on an Army cot. We would get up in the morning, 0600, something like that, go to the mess hall. After we shaved and showered in the morning, we'd go to our mess hall, and then there would be a company formation. At 0800, they'd read whatever orders or stuff we needed to know, and then we would do a police call through the area to our places of business. And then I would spend the rest of the day in a building, not air conditioned, right on the side of the airfield, doing paperwork and pounding on a typewriter. And that would go on from, 8 o'clock in the morning till 5 or 6 o'clock at night, 6 days a week. We had Sundays off. So, really, it certainly was not the life I had expected to lead as an infantryman.
Right, yeah.
And I every even as bad as things could sometimes be, I slept in a bed every night I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And as an infantryman, I lived in absolute fear of either injury or the fact that I was going to be filthy for a year.
I managed to avoid those things, at least at the early stage, I guess.
Yeah.
What about when you were finished with work for the day?
Go back to the billet. We had a movie screen behind our billets where they would periodically get, once, twice a week, they would get a movie. So we'd all go out and watch the movie.
What type of movies would you see?
Oh, it's just whatever was going around at the time. I think I remembered 20 Million BC with Raquel Welch. I followed that movie all around the base just to watch her run around in her little squirrel skin bikini. Go to the EM Club, have a couple of beers, you know, write letters home, read, play bridge. It literally, you know, at the end of the day, at 6 o'clock, unless you had interior guard duty or called for KP, your day was over.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, given the circumstances, as comfortable an environment as you could ask for.
Were you ever called for KP or guard duty?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. So, in fact, I was called for KP the night that I found out. I had signed up. There was a service called Mars where you could make a telephone call home.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to put your request in months in advance. Well, late in the day of the night I was supposed to have the call, or the evening, I went to the board, and all of a sudden there's my name for KP. And I can't find anybody, you know, I can't find the first sergeant, I can't find the company commander to plead my case with. So I missed my call home, did my KP. I was so infuriated when I came back. The battalion commander had recently had little banana trees planted in front of all the billets to spruce up the area. I must have seen Mr. Roberts one time too often. I went in and grabbed a survival knife, which was standard equipment with helicopter crews, and chopped down every damn banana tree in our company area. And the next morning, there was a formation call. People were asked, you know, did anybody have any information? And in typical good Army way of handling things, every one of the guys, you know, many of whom had watched this, had no idea who'd done it.
They saw you do it, but still wouldn't say anything.
Sure.
Yeah.
You never read it out, friend.
For sure, yeah. Sure.
So, I happened to have interior guard the night our base was hit. It was one of four bases hit with 122 millimeter and 140 millimeter rockets, which was the first time it was ever done in the 3rd Corps. I happened to be on interior guard when it started.
Can you take me through that event?
Sure. Yeah, it's funny in a way, in that I'd been there now 7 months. Up till then, we would get occasional attacks on the base, but they would be mortar attacks. And the mortars were always put down on the flight line because that's where the expensive equipment is.
Mm-hmm.
So we got rather blasé about this. We clerks, I remember pouring a drink, climbing up on the roof of the billet, and watching the mortar rounds fall on the airfield. Well, these things weren't very accurate. Anyway, by that point, I had, we'd never had anything like this, and I was getting rather lackadaisical. So I did my first 2 hours. And all interior guard is walking the company area. You're really a fire watch. You're there just to alert anybody if, you know, a fire breaks out or somebody's too drunk to find their way to their billet, you help them get there. When my second round came, I think that was between midnight and 2, after walking around for a bit, I thought, Jesus, this is really boring. And I dropped into the Quonset hut where company headquarters was, where the company clerk was the CQ runner that night. And I'm there jawing with Specialist Washington, and all of a sudden somebody sticks his head in the door and says, hey, you two, I think we're under attack. So Washington and I decided, you know, it's our job to get people awake and headed to the bunkers. So between two of us, we agreed to split the company area in half. And we started running from billet to billet as these rounds were coming in, making sure that everybody was up and headed for the bunker. The first billet I got to, I forgot, was one peopled by some cooks. And they used to sit out in the front of their billet in lawn chairs having final smoke before they left for work about 11 o'clock. I had forgotten all about that, and I came running at that billet at full tilt with a flashlight in one hand and a shotgun in the other, hit those chairs and flew through the air and skidded across the concrete floor. Anyway, we took some casualties, and as a result of that, of what we did, both Washington and I were put up for and received the Bronze Star.
Is that right?
Yeah. Not what you expect as a clerk.
No, it's not. And again, when these things happen, sometimes you don't think so much as react and do what you're trained to do or what you think is right.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, when it was finally over and I got into a bunker myself, I tried to light a cigarette and my hand was shaking so hard I couldn't control the match.
How long were you guys out running around getting?
You know, I don't think it could have lasted more than 5 minutes, because we each had 20 billets to run into and to wake people. One of the ones that I had been in 30 seconds after I'd been in it was hit with a rocket. And fortunately, and there's ones where I had close friends, they had gotten up, moved out of the back of the billet, stopped to put on their boots, which was stupid, and were in it when the rocket hit it, but it hit right at the seam where the concrete floor met the dirt, traveled under the concrete floor or detonating. They were all injured, but lightly injured, whereas if it had been any higher or if it had hit 30 seconds earlier, it would have killed them all and wounded me as well.
So you saved lives doing this.
Yeah, I did. I like to feel that four people lived who wouldn't have if it wasn't for me.
That's got to be a great feeling even today.
It is. Yeah. It is.
Tell me, Vic, what's it like to be under attack like that? These are 122s. These are, not that the mortars aren't dangerous, because they obviously are, but you kind of explained that situation. 122s are coming in the middle of the night. What's that like for you?
Well, first off, it was like nothing I'd ever heard before. They hiss on the way in. The propellant has gone out long before that, and you're just hearing the hiss of this thing coming in very rapidly. And then when it hit, I had lived a mile or half mile from a highway, and I can remember at home as a kid sometimes on a Saturday night, you'd hear the sound of an accident, and it sounded, you'd hear a screech of brakes, and then it would sound like somebody hit a galvanized trash can full of glass with a baseball bat. That's pretty much what the sound was like when these things detonated. And it was close. The next morning, I policed up shrapnel where I'd been on the ground that clearly had Cyrillic markings on it.
So you're saying Soviet-made, most likely. Then.
Yeah, they were Soviet-made, sure.
Yeah.
And I wish I'd saved it, but it had rusted so badly by the time I was leaving, I just checked them out.
Yeah. You mentioned that some of these guys got injured. How many were injured overall?
Well, again, nobody ever tells you anything when you're an enlisted man, but the jungle grapevine always has information. We had aviation units at three of the four first infantry bases that were hit, and word had it that we had 84 casualties, some of which were severe.
This is a pretty extensive attack, then.
It was, yeah. The thinking was that the 1st Infantry had been doing a real job on Charlie for the last couple of months, and it was all directed. They hit Lyke, Phuc Vinh, Dao Tiang, and Phu Loi, all of which were 1st Infantry bases. Mm-hmm. This was just a reminder from the Phu Loi DC Battalion that they were still out there.
Yeah. What happens as a result of this? Do the missions pick up? Do the helicopters take off? You're flying out and kind of clearing the vicinity again. What goes on with
well,
the
you know,
aviation
ships went up. They actually the counter battery. We have counter battery radar. We also have an artillery unit on base, mostly track mounted 155 howitzers. They had actually located through the radar where some of this was coming from, and put up, you know, counter battery fire. The mortars were being manned, and they did. They found out when they looked the next morning that they had managed to silence a couple of them. The rockets had all been set up on literally bamboo shoots or cut in half to make a launch ramp and set on a timer, so there was nobody to be hit where the rockets were coming from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And my wife, who has gone through 9/11 working in New York, you know, which is a horrendous experience, but talked about, you know, all the counseling they got, you know, they didn't have to go back in until they were ready. I said, well, you know, granted that what you went through is much worse than I did, but I tell you, you know, I turned in at 0200, and at 0600, I was expected to be back on duty, and nobody was offering any counseling.
Yeah, obviously a completely different situation,
yeah.
Times,
you just get up
culture.
And you start the next day.
Yeah. Was it difficult for you, or are you still kind of shaken as a result of this?
I was then. I didn't realize it till I got home. I'd never heard of post-traumatic syndrome, but our apartment, which was on the 12th floor of a high-rise in Richmond, had a railroad track that ran along the river, James River, right below us, and they used to stop and change cars there. So every night, about 2 o'clock in the morning, it would be a clang.
Mm-hmm.
And the first night I was home, and I heard that asleep, and next thing I knew, I was under the bed.
Is that right?
Yeah. So yeah, it did. And it was for years after that that I could not go to fireworks or I remember I was out at the bicycle club riding, and where we stopped, they were doing a Civil War enactment, and they started firing off the muskets, and after about 5 minutes, I told the group I had to leave. That I just got fidgety and uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of noise.
Did you attribute that to perhaps PTSD or to your Vietnam experience?
Well, by then, yeah, I certainly knew it was
yeah.
a Vietnam experience.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if I knew had heard that term yet.
A little while ago, you were talking about writing letters. How important was it for you to not just write the letters, but to receive the letters from your wife and parents? Or
oh,
did your
very
parents
important. You know, I wanted to know how things were going, how her pregnancy was going. I decided effort to sort of underplay whatever danger there might be. I just told her about all the happy stuff with my friends. Which when I finally tell her I was getting a bronze star, she knew there was some, maybe she wasn't getting all the information.
Yeah. Well, and that's probably for the best, and it's certainly
yeah.
a common kind of thing to approach
but,
it that way.
The mail was very, very important to us, and they did a terrific job of getting it to us.
What's it like for you to be newly married with a baby on the way, and being that far away, being in the combat zone?
Well, it certainly it did a couple of things. One was I felt I had a responsibility to that baby and my wife to not do some things that I might want to. I really wanted to be, in spite of my luck, a little bit more of part of what was actively pursuing the war. And our security platoon, all the time I was there, there were levies coming down. They were always looking for infantrymen. The armored cab unit across the base from us had a long-range reconnaissance patrol. Patrol LERP unit whose job was to go out and scour the area for 5 or 10 kilometers around the base to make sure nobody had set up business there. And they invited some of the security platoon people to come over for 90 days, at the end of which you would go back to us and you would have a combat infantry badge and
sure.
be entitled to wear a 1st Infantry Division patch.
And that's not anything to be sneezed at. That's very important. And the combat arms.
There was part of me that really wanted to do that. But again, I felt, you know, it wasn't a decision I could make for myself because I wasn't making decisions for me anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, I'd been dealt a good hand and I owed it to Brenda and to my yet unnamed child to not squander that. But there's part of me that wanted to do it.
You said that there were two things. One was that you wouldn't perhaps take the chances that you normally or possibly might have. What was the other?
Well, let's see. I'm not sure whether I was referring to this or something else, but I did once talk my way into flying on a mission on a Sunday with the unit that was taking 25th Infantry out some kind of operation they were doing. Turned out that while I was flying, my wife had tried to get in contact with me to tell me that my daughter had been born. Now, it actually had nothing to do with my flying. It turned out that the Red Cross then sent the information to the wrong APO. They sent it to a European one, the 0979. And it took a couple of weeks to unscramble, during which she interpreted the information they couldn't find me, that I was missing in action. So it wasn't directly that my flying that day prevented any of that happening, but boy, when that happened and I found out, I said, you know, you should never, ever, ever do anything like that again.
Yeah. Well, it must have been terrifying for your wife.
Oh, it was. It was. About 2 weeks later, I got called down to personnel, and they said, you're in big trouble, buddy. I said, what do you mean? He said, we've got a congressman's aide on the phone. Says, your wife has been told you're missing in action. You better get on that phone and tell that congressman's staff member that you're here and you're fine.
Well, word travels fast.
Yeah. And to make it up to her, when the Richmond Red Cross published their 1968 calendars, there was a photo of her and my baby daughter on the calendar. So, oops, we goofed.
Yeah. You've talked about how it affected you to be a husband and prospective father here. What was it like? What do you think it was like for your wife back at home?
Well, she lived with a lot of fear because, you know, again, I think anyone who's, you know, at the other end of it, all you get is the relenting news coverage. And, it's always a battle. It's never very clear where it is. So the people left behind seem to think, you know, are left with the impression that this is the way you live 24 hours a day. I've got to say, if I was in danger more than 1 or 2% of the time I was there, that would be surprise me.
Mm-hmm.
I had some incidences that were hairy, but most of the time I was safe, and most of the time I thought I was safe, I was. So I think it's much harder to be on the other end of it.
Yeah, just the not knowing and being so far away.
Exactly.
And, of course, we're not dealing with technology like we have today where you can Skype or call or whatever else is available.
Oh, no. All you do is write a letter, and it would go airmail, and so it was about 3 or 4 days for letters to get over to you and back again.
Mm-hmm. And that could be a very long 3 or 4 days.
Yeah. If something was not so good in the last letter, yeah.
And how often would you and your wife write each other?
Oh, I'd say daily.
Daily?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or as close to that as we could.
Well, Vic, we're at a pretty good point to stop for today.
Okay.
This is Kelly Krager continuing an oral history interview with Mr. Victor Berry. Today is 1 April 2016. I am in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Vic is joining me by phone, again from his home in Cranford, New Jersey. Okay, Vic, we left off last time discussing, I guess, base life is one way to put it,
mm-hmm.
at Fulloy. You get there, and I believe it was January of 67. You mentioned that there was another story that you wanted to relate about your time there, but it was somewhat unusual for, given your position.
Yeah, yes, it was. In my last month there, so this must have been in November, late November, early December, and I had been promoted to E5 by then. I was sitting on a Sunday down in the Quonset hut for our headquarters, I think again with my buddy Specialist Washington, who had the adventure with me during the rocket attack.
Mm-hmm.
And a fellow burst in the front door, and he's got an AK-57 with two 50-round banana clips in it. And he is livid. He's in a state of rage. So I calmed him down and said, you know, what's the problem? He said, well, I'm coming back from a special leave. Now, if you extended for 6 months, you would get a 30-day special leave home. Most people extended to get out of combat duty. This guy was in a state of rage, though, because he was a door gunner with one of our aviation companies, which was the one in the worst place and had the worst safety record of any of our aviation companies. He had extended specifically to have 6 more months to fly as a door gunner with them. And when he got orders to go to our security platoon. And so I tried to calm him down. I said, look, you know, if you had extended to fly with the Vultures for another 6 months, that will be honored. It's obviously a mistake, but that's got to be corrected in the personnel office, and it doesn't open until Monday morning. So what I'm going to ask you to do, because we have a very strict no personal weapons policy at Fulloy, to go around to the back of this Quonset hut, turn in the AK with our armorer. He'll give you a receipt. Monday morning, we'll, you know, go over to personnel. You'll get your orders to go back to Phuc Vinh, pick up your weapon, and God go with you. And I sort of forgot about it. Didn't go with him to see what he was doing, just assumed he would do it.
Mm-hmm.
That evening, I was in the Quonset hut again, and a couple of guys burst into the Quonset hut and said, there's a soldier in the EM club waving an AK around and threatening to kill people. Well, I knew immediately who it was.
Yeah.
You got to realize now, I'm within 3 weeks of going home. I've got a brand new baby waiting for me. So my bit of initial bravery was to say, you know, gee, that's really too bad. Somebody ought to tell the company commander. He said, we can't. He's in Saigon with his whore. I said, well, that's too bad. Why don't you tell the first sergeant? He said, can't do that. He's in Saigon with his whore. I said, gee, well, then who's the ranking NCO? They said, you are.
Oh, goodness.
So I went over to the EM club, knowing full well, you know, who this had to be. And, you know, I don't have a lot of cards to play with. I'm unarmed. I figured the best thing I've got to do is talk rationally and politely to this guy and try to discuss with him that he's on the verge of getting in a great deal of trouble, but we can keep that from happening if he'll give the weapon to me. And we will then take it to the armorer, as was discussed. Well, I go over there, and sure enough, it's this guy. And he's waving the thing around. I go over to him. Now he's got it pointed at me. And I said, you know, we talked about this earlier today. I really need to have you check this weapon in with the armorer. So far, nothing has happened. But, you know, if this goes further, you could be in a great deal of trouble. Would you please give the weapon to me? And I don't know how long it was, maybe 15 seconds or so, but it's a long time when you're looking down the muzzle of an AK-47.
Yeah.
And at the end of that time, he handed me the weapon. And that was it. There was never any, you know, I never told anybody about it. There was no, I didn't do anything to get him in trouble. There was no recognition of it by any of the senior NCOs or the company commander. They were completely unaware of it. But it was, you know, again, kind of unusual for a personnel specialist, and certainly not the kind of excitement I wanted with just a couple of weeks to go.
Well, any time for that matter, but
yeah,
certainly not being a short-timer like you were. So what was the story here? You'd already talked to this guy. Was he just unbalanced?
Yeah, I think he was unbalanced.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously hadn't done what I asked him to do. And probably, you know, that evening went over to the M Club, had a few too many drinks, and worked himself up into a rage again. It's, you know, my best guess.
Yeah. So nothing ever came of this? You didn't
nothing
have to report
ever came
him?
Of it. I never said anything of it. I figured he was the 160 seconds problem, and now he was going back to them. And, you know.
And was that indeed what happened?
Yeah.
Next
morning, he, you know, got his orders corrected and went back to the 162nd up in Fukvin.
Well, that seems like a pretty poor career choice of behavior there.
I mean, we had lots of people who came to us. An aviation company, a battalion, has something called a Pathfinder Detachment,
mm-hmm.
which is a holdover from the old airborne days, and we had a Pathfinder Detachment. And these guys, they were all jump qualified, and their job was a team of two or three of them would go into an LZ before the landing to scout it out and then also be there to radio into the ships about wind speed and from what direction and what was the best exit direction to go. These guys, to a man, with one exception, were all from the 101st Airborne. The other one was from the 173rd. They had all extended 6 months to get out of, you know, infantry assignments.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, I worked with several other guys from the 199th as clerks with me who had extended 6 months to get out of the infantry. This nut job, for some reason, decided he liked things just the way they were. He just wanted more of it.
Mm-hmm. That brings up another question here, I think. In your position, you saw a lot of folks.
Yes.
Coming and going through your office, dealing with the whole personnel, red tape, administrative, mm-hmm. whatever. Or could you comment on the morale, the disposition of the unit as you saw these guys?
I would say it was pretty good. Now, remember, this is 1967.
Mm-hmm.
There really aren't organized protests yet in the States, or not much of them. We're all the same age group, which means many of us had fathers who served during the Second World War and been brought up with the belief that that was, you know, part of the rites of passage of a male in the United States was military service, and if your country called on you, you know, you responded. So, by and large, I would say that the morale was good. We did have one Korean-American cook who kept going AWOL and trying to catch a flight back to Korea at Saigon. And of course, he never could pass himself off as a civilian. And would just be brought back to us about every 3 months by the MPs. but by and large, the morale was good. And there was a great deal of, aviation companies, I guess, since, you know, all the pilots are volunteers, all the crew chiefs are helicopter mechanics who volunteered to fly, so are the door gunners, they're infantrymen who volunteered to fly. They were very proud of their units and proud of what they did.
What other sorts of things, in addition to the morale and this other problem, did you see going on in the unit? Now, that's kind of a vague question, but as someone in your position, you're going to see, all kinds of people are coming through. What kinds of issues did you come across? What kind of attitudes? What kind of different personalities did you meet? What sort of things, from your perspective, would kind of drive the outfit in a personnel kind of sense?
Well, certainly one thing I saw, and it had some tragic consequences in our security platoon, because they, unlike the rest of us, were required to keep their weapons with them in their billets in case, you know, they were suddenly called out en masse to man the bunkers. And these, by and large, were younger. I mean, we clerks who had fallen into clerking from other training were almost all college graduates, so we were 22, 23 years old. Whereas our security platoon people generally were draftees, some were enlistees, but they were non-college graduates, 18 or 19 years old. And we lost either three or four during the year who took their own lives when they got a Dear John letter.
Is that right?
Yeah. So, you know, I think part of it, you know, part of how you responded, it was age and worldliness. You know, for a lot of these guys, this is the first time away from home. I had, you know, been to Europe in high school and then worked in France one summer in college. So I had some experience away from home and in strange surroundings. The other thing I commented on earlier, although I saw no, we weren't having the race riots and stuff that seemed to come along later, the whites and the blacks pretty much kept to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they just socialized with their own race and not with one another. There were a couple of exceptions, but not a lot.
You talked about the Dear John letter. What would happen when someone, obviously this happened, like you said, about three times, I guess.
Yeah.
What would happen when someone committed suicide? What would be the response of the unit?
None that I recall. I mean, this all came through word of mouth. You know, there was no, that I recall, ever any, you know, we were never called together as a group and told about it or counseled in any way.
Any sort of specific paperwork that would need to be done, contacting the next of kin, anything like that?
There must have been, but I was unaware of what it would be.
Yeah, outside of your bailiwick, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah. You mentioned that the races kind of stayed apart, and this is a difficult time, getting ready to get more difficult, obviously,
yes,
both in the States and in Vietnam. But did you detect any sort of animosity, any sort of anxiety between the races? And again, this is 67, and you're a combat unit, and that's a different dynamic. But did you detect anything that was possibly going on there?
Not really. You know, there were the differences. There were, you know, the special handshakes and stuff like that that you only saw in the infantry units and among the black troopers.
Mm-hmm.
And every unit had a slightly different one to distinguish itself, but you know, no, it was, I think it was just sort of a carryover from the way life was at home,
mm-hmm,
which, you know, wasn't overtly hostile, but it certainly was, you know, sort of separate and distinct lives.
What about the issue of drugs in your unit? Obviously drug use is a is an important topic when it comes to the Vietnam War.
I never saw any drug use. And now again, we're an aviation unit,
mm-hmm,
and flying and drugs just don't mix well.
Yeah.
Certainly, I heard about its use with the infantry units, and I heard about use way back in the rear areas, like in Saigon. But I never saw any.
You talk about the rear units and the combat units, and there is a real difference between the two.
Oh, there is.
And you're kind of, although we like to draw this very distinct line, this is a RIMF, and this is a combat soldier, and never the twain shall meet except that, you know, some sort of personnel office or something.
Yeah.
But you're kind of caught in between there.
Yeah, I was
between
an REMF who had been trained as an infantryman and serving with a combat or combat support unit.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I was neither one nor the other, really. and had exposure to both.
Can you describe what that general, I guess, feelings were between the rear echelon types and the combat types in general, and then what you experienced as someone who wasn't really quite either?
Well, I know for a fact, like one of my buddies there was one of the two guys who'd come to us from the 199th Light Infantry, who'd been OCS dropouts, were caught up when that unit was being formed up, and shipped over as grunts, and they extended 6 months eventually. And one day, Foxy, who was one of the two guys, and I said, you know, I'd like to take you up to Long Bin and take you to the 199th Light Infantry Bar, but he said, when we get there, let me go in, because anybody from another unit shows up at their bar. You know, this is just a bar that they've declared to be their divisional bar. There could be trouble. So he said, when we get up there, I want you to wait outside. I'm going to go in, tell them you're a good guy, and ask permission to bring you in. Which he got, and everything went fine. But, I mean, there was that kind of cohesiveness about infantry divisions.
Mm-hmm.
They were very, very... I'm not sure if insular is the right word, but they, you know, they lived day in and day out with one another and had a fierce pride in themselves. And so there's that. Kind of a related one was somewhere, and it's a difference I always felt between the Army-trained clerks and me. I'd been trained to be in the infantry. I had done a lot of close-order drill, fire and maneuver work. You know, we were taught that, you know, if something goes wrong, if somebody yells grenade or something, you drop to the ground. The clerks would sort of, well, you know, how come he's yelling that? I'm an E4 and he's only an E3. Or he got to yell it last time. Why isn't it my turn? At one point, they decided within our company that they were going to set up what they called a ready reaction force, which was if and it never happened, Charlie ever got through the wire and past the bunkers, we would have organized defense with the clerks and cooks and the like, and they took those of us who had infantry background, and I was one of them, and assigned us a group of these folks as our own. And I watched these guys, and I thought the most dangerous thing in the world is a clerk or a cook with a rifle.
Hmm.
It was a stupid idea, and I was glad that we never had to put it into action.
Can you tell me about how this came together? Was there any sort of training, any sort of weapons familiarization, any sort of tactical work or training to...
Not really. It was hastily thought through. I spent a little time with some of them talking about it and showing them, you know, everybody had to qualify with an M14 in basic anyway, but a little, you know, talk to them about, you know, what you would do and handling of weapons and security, but it never went so far as going out to the range and live firing together or anything.
Yeah. It sounds like most of these folks, you know, their MOS was such that when they're done with basic training, they're going on to their school specialty.
Yeah, they went off to clerk school. And the end of seeing this stuff was, you know, I had 8 weeks or it was intensified.
Hmm.
But, yeah, I also, again, I was delighted to be a clerk. I love these people, but I always felt that there was a difference between them and me.
Mm-hmm.
They seemed to lack respect for the infantrymen. And I had enormous respect for them and just enormous thankfulness that I hadn't had to play out that role.
Yeah. What about the infantrymen and their attitude toward these clerk types?
Well, I didn't spend a great deal of time with them except sometimes on flights out to LZs, but they would have thought very little of them.
Right, sure.
Although I'll tell you, the guy when I got back to the States and I went to Fort Monroe for my last posting, the guy I replaced was a Spec 5, just like me, from the 173rd Airborne, with a CIB and jump wings, and and a Bronze Star. I mean, we're like carbon copies of one another, only that he had been with the 173rd. So here again, here was somebody who was sort of in that, you know, strange role.
Yeah.
He was definitely airborne infantry, but he was doing the same thing I was doing.
Maybe he got lucky as well.
I think he must have.
Yeah, that assignment. What about rest and relaxation? Did you go on R&R?
I did go on R&R. It's a shame. I was going to meet my wife and take it in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
But then she was having trouble with the pregnancy and wrote me, said that she wasn't allowed to fly. So instead, I went to Bangkok with a friend.
And how was Bangkok in 1967?
Oh, it's wonderful. My strongest recollection is running a hot tub of water and climbing into it. And at the third bath, I had gotten all the red laterite dust out of my skin. It was absolutely wonderful.
Yeah. Anything else that you guys did, seeing the sights, anything?
Well, yeah, we had a very funny experience. We, the deal was you would go to a bar, cat house, and select the girl who would be your girl for the week. And you would also hire a cab driver for the week who would be yours. And I still remember one afternoon, I guess he'd been there two or three days, Mr. Tim came to us and said, the cab driver, is it all right if I take the evening off? And we said, sure, that's fine. He said, a friend of mine is getting married. We said, well, absolutely, you know, you want to attend that. He said, no, I've got a better idea. Why don't you come too?
Hmm.
And we said, well, you know, it's a very personal thing, a wedding. We should have no business there. He said, well, I don't really mean a wedding. It's the dinner after the wedding. It's on a rooftop restaurant. There'll be hundreds of people, and no one will notice you. I thought, right. But we went. We had a wonderful, wonderful evening. Had experience, you know, a non-manufactured experience in Bangkok.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and we got to meet the bride and the groom.
That was the least you could do since you're eating their food and drinking their booze, I assume. About when in your tour did you go to Bangkok?
I would say that must have been about 6 or 7 months in.
Okay, so about halfway into it.
Yeah.
All right. Now, you were there with the first. Early on in 67, two major operations are underway, or will soon be underway, Cedar Falls and Junction City.
Yes.
Taking place there in your AO.
Absolutely right.
Can you talk about either or both of these operations and what, and I know that you weren't involved in the actual operations as far as going out, but tell me about both of these operations as you recall.
I'm trying to think. Cedar Falls was very early, I think, occurred just as I was arriving. If I remember the order, and I remember nothing about that. I think I was just getting, you know, acclimated. I do remember, if I'm correct, that Junction City was around April. Walking out to the airfield to go to the personnel office, and the entire airfield was covered with UEs with markings from units I'd never seen before. And nobody had mentioned the operation, but clearly I could see that something major was happening.
Mm-hmm.
That was the degree of my awareness of it after that, other than reading about it in Stars and Stripes.
So there was no sort of uptick in paperwork or what's going on?
No.
Any new people coming in, going out, nothing like
that? No. I'll give you one other incident, though, I guess that did. Have you ever heard of the book, They Walked Into Sunlight?
No, I don't believe I'm familiar with that.
It's a book written about events in two places that take place over the same three-day period in November of 67.
Okay.
One is the student riots at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, to keep Dow Chemical and others from recruiting. The other is the worst ambush of a unit in the history of Vietnam, which occurred at the far end of the Iron Triangle in November, when a two-company unit from the 1st Infantry, whose Lieutenant Colonel Battalion Commander was the son of a famous 1st Division general from World War II, and decided he had to lift the effectiveness of his unit and his the awareness of him. Anyway, they bumbled into a regimental-sized unit, which, unbeknown to them and unknown to me at the time, was being withdrawn back towards Cambodia to prepare for Tet.
Hmm.
And in that, our company took, which is the 173rd at Lai Kha, took the full complement of slicks to carry those two companies out. They made the mistake, led by this lieutenant colonel, to think that they were ambushing this regimental unit, which tried its best to avoid them because they had missed food points for months. They were tired, they were hungry, they were just trying to get to Cambodia to refit. But when they couldn't, decimated this unit. It took less than one platoon of slicks, which would be 8 UEs, which is good for about 50 people, to carry the survivors back.
Mm.
And while all this is going on, I'm hearing about it from the guys in the headquarters that they've got a stranded unit on the phone. There's a Spec 4 and a PFC on the radio. They say they've got no NCOs or officers standing. The next day, there was this flurry of 1st Division people, and I remember there was Lieutenant Colonel Chaplin amongst them. I had never seen a chaplain above the rank of captain, so I figured this must have been the division chaplain. So I guess, you know, that's the only other sort of major thing I can remember.
Yeah.
You know, it's a kind of war that, other than, you know, like the Battle of the Adrang in November of 65 and the invasion of Cambodia, there were a lot of things that were given lots of names, but there really weren't that many, and obviously Tet, major engagements.
Mm-hmm. Kind of the nature of the war, and especially
yeah.
dealing with a VC
yeah.
Down where you were.
And that's right. We spent the entire year chasing what was called the Fuloy Battalion of the VC. They were caught in Cholon during Tet and completely wiped out.
Mm.
I had a friend who did extend so that he could get out when he finished his time, and he was there during Tet and told me about later. And about they were down at the Futo racetrack, carrying the 199th to mop up what was left of the Fuloy Battalion.
Hmm. So they made it all the way down to the outskirts of Saigon, Cholon area.
Yeah, they were in Saigon. Yeah,
Saigon. Yeah,
they were operating out of Cholon. I guess they brought them back from the field into Cholon for when Tet started, so that they'd be present in Saigon.
Interesting. While we're on the topic of the enemy, can you talk to me about what you knew about the VC? Who were these people? What kind of fighters were they? What did you know about them?
Well, what we know, and again, what I know being in an office is what I'm being told.
Mm-hmm.
But the Fuloy Battalion, which is who we were operating against at the time, tended to be older. They were cadre who had fought the French in the 50s. So the senior cadres are in their, you know, 30s, the early 40s. They were very good soldiers, but very poorly equipped. So, without the mobility that aviation gave our infantry units, and without artillery support and all that, when there was a closing engagement, and they certainly avoided those unless, you know, they thought they had advantage, they always came out on the wrong end.
Mm-hmm.
But we had great respect for them because they were very good soldiers. You know, you used to think about it. You know, here I am playing soldier after 4 months of training, and these guys have, you know, 12, 20 years of it.
Right.
I'm doing what I've been told and read about. These guys know what the hell they're doing, and thank God they're not better equipped.
Yeah.
My friend Don said after that the whole nature of what they're encountering changed because the VC were pretty well wiped out.
Yeah.
In Saigon, there are a number of historians that feel that the VC weren't set into cities by accident, that the North had felt they had to take control of the war because they didn't think the VC were doing a good enough job. And he said, starting around March, he said what we were up against was regular NVA units. And he said these guys were a whole different ball game. They were as well equipped as we were, other than the aviation. They had a better artillery piece than we did. Arguably, the AK-47 was certainly a more reliable weapon than the M16.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, then it was just, he said, it's very different from what you remember.
What about their tactics? What about the way they approached the war? I mean, like you said, they've been there. It's their home ground. They've been doing this for a long time. What about the way they fought the war?
What was the last word you said?
What about the way the VC fought the war?
Well, I'll tell you, my final assignment was at Fort Monroe, where I worked in a very small unit. The company commander and the XO there were both 25th Infantry Division platoon leaders. So I'll tell you what they told me. He said one of the things that they said was that when they encountered the VC, and it was usually in an ambush, the VC had dug deep trenches and fired over the top of them, frequently not even looking out, just holding the weapons up and spraying the area in front of them. He said the result was that we took most of our wounds in the lower extremities. He said when we did shoot someone, it was invariably in the head because of the way they'd placed themselves. I personally don't have a lot of experience with their tactics. I mean, they would, harass us on the perimeter at night, either with occasionally with 60-millimeter mortar fire on the airfield, and certainly small weapons fire on the perimeter. But I'm probably not the one to be able to tell you more about that.
No, and I certainly understand that. And given your perspective and what your role was, that obviously makes sense. But nonetheless, you still do have a perspective and something.
Oh, let me tell you one other story.
Sure.
Again, and this is, it's in the last month I'm there. I'm anxious to go home. I've had now about 11 months of commissioned officers deciding that they're smarter than anybody else and don't need to be any advice from enlisted men. We started getting fire on the bay, on the perimeter, which was what I had been taught to do as a probing attack of defenses in the infantry, and that is part of our perimeter would come under fire as soon as the perimeter responded with everything it had there. It would break off, and 20 minutes later it would appear 50 meters down the perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
Now I understood this as mapping defenses. What I didn't realize was this is all in preparation for Tet. And I should have told someone, but at that point my reaction was, what, that's just what you expect from a bunch of aviators. They have no idea what's going on, no idea of infantry tactics, and you know what? I'm tired of dealing with commissioned officers. Let them find out for themselves. And they did.
Yeah.
Of course, I had no idea that Tet was going to take place, and I've always been embarrassed that I didn't make an effort to try and bring it to somebody's attention that they were doing exactly the worst thing they could possibly do, which is telling these guys exactly what they had all along their perimeter.
Right. Do you think it would have made any difference had you told someone?
I don't know. It certainly would have made a difference, I think, if they knew that the base defenses were being systematically mapped. Maybe if I hadn't, but maybe if, a commissioned officer had told them.
Might have had a little more impact, probably. Yeah. Well, what about, you mentioned a couple of different occasions about being close to going home. You're a short-timer. What's it like to be a short-timer? What is your, does your routine change? Does your attitude change? Tell me about being a short-timer.
Well, first thing, every hooch or group of people would have what they called a short stick, which is like an English officer's swagger stick, but had been hand-carved by, you know, a local Vietnamese craftsman. And the deal was always that the shortest guy in whatever the group it was carried it with him. And then when
shortest meaning the guy who has the least amount of time to serve in Vietnam.
Yeah, and there, you know, there are all kinds of jokes. You know, I'm so short, if I stepped off the end of a dime, I'd fall down, and, you know, things like that. And so you would then pass this on when you left, to the next shortest guy. They also made an effort, if they could, and they certainly could with me as a clerk. The last week I had there, they just gave me off. And we actually had a swimming pool on the base, which I had never been in. And I spent my last week lazing around the swimming pool.
Not bad?
Not bad at all.
Yeah. Now, as a clerk, it's obviously, again, different from being out in the field. And oftentimes the short-timer syndrome could be a good or bad thing, depending on how you chose to view it. But in where you were at the camp in Phu Loi, probably not as many life or death decisions, depending on, you know, how careful you are doing these kinds of things. I just didn't know if it would affect your daily routine at all.
Right. I've been told and read that, you know, an infantry unit, say, would make a conscious choice, if they could afford to do it, to get the short timer out of the field, because for him it was a life and death situation.
Yeah.
Mine certainly wasn't.
Well, you're over there fighting a war in Vietnam. Can you tell me about the Vietnamese?
I knew a little bit about them. I learned some more while I was there, only because I spoke fluent French and could speak to some of the older people. You know, I learned the usual pidgin French that pidgin Vietnamese every GI learn, but, you know, they were just short phrases and the like. But I found with some of the older people, given time, if I spoke French with them, they would open up with me a lot more. I went through a rash of feelings. Initially, sympathy. I had, had traveled and lived abroad, so I was sensitive to being, you know, to understanding the people I was with. I'd have to say, as time went on and we became frustrated with the fighting performance of the Arvin and not being able to engage the VC because the village the fire was coming from was, quote, friendly, I can remember one point thinking, damn, this would be a great war if only we get the damn Vietnamese out of the way to fight it. There was a girl in the local bar downtown who I would chat with, who was very bright, and she had told me, I asked her once, I said, why didn't she go to the university? I said, you're very smart. She spoke English and French both. She said, well, I'm Buddhist. And said, the ruling elite in this country is French-educated Catholics. And said, there's no place in the university for me. And the longer I was there, the more I began to feel that the local Vietnamese, and where we were, they were all Buddhist, or maybe some Cao Dai further west, were just caught in an impossible position. We demanded loyalty from them, and the joke was, we controlled the day, Charlie controlled the night. Charlie, who would be in their villages at night, would demand their loyalty, and they just had no place to run and hide. If somebody was always angry with them for not being loyal enough to him. But I just saw them really as in a horrible position.
You mentioned that you were oftentimes less than happy with the performance of the Arvin. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, and again, this is all word of mouth from the air crew,
sure.
The infantry who've been with them. But whenever the Arvin were brought into what turned out to be a hot LZ, the performance was terrible, and generally American infantry were sent in. We had, within the UE companies, examples of Arvin soldiers debarking the ship and then turning around and firing on it, to where for in some units the crew chief would carry an M79 with canister round and would make it very clear that nobody turns back towards the helicopter after you debark it, or I open up on you. So they were certainly considered to be, at the very best, poorly motivated, poorly led. Sometimes their ranks were infiltrated by VC. So we had a very low opinion of them. Now, I have to say, one of the things I learned there was we had a housemaid, as everybody, every billet did. Well, I think we chipped in $10 a month, so she made $40 a month for washing our clothes and sweeping up the billet. Her husband was a master sergeant in the Arvin, a career soldier, and she was out earning him at $40 a month as a maid for the U.S. So, some of the lack of enthusiasm and professionalism, I think, with the Arvin was how poorly they were paid. Many of their officers, and certainly was true for regional commanders, were political appointees who were not properly trained at all.
Yeah. Well, what about this leadership? I mean, obviously these things start at the top and work their way down. And you mentioned that some of these are political appointees and that there's going to be corruption taking place. That's obviously a well-known fact of what took place there. And a lot of it was cultural. It's not completely black and white.
Goes on today in China.
and always has and probably always will. And big units like that, you would expect that.
And part of it again was, and I had sympathy for, a little bit more sympathy for it later when I realized what Arvin civil servants made. Essentially, they were in a system that underpaid them, and they were supposed to supplement their income by, if you wanted anything that you were entitled to as a citizen, like a license, a permission to do something, money had to change hands before that request was filled. And, it seems to have been an accepted way of doing it in a lot of the Middle East and a lot of Southeast Asia, that a little bakshish to make things happen was just the way the system worked, and everybody was aware of it.
Mm-hmm. What about the American command at the top? Mentioned the Arvin just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to get your thoughts on the top leadership in the United States, and you can take that from the political leadership all the way down to field grade officers. But what was your opinion of the military leadership in particular there in Vietnam?
Well, some of it I thought was pretty good. The infantry division commanders. We all worshipped General Westmoreland. Though, in retrospect, his successor was much better, but Westmoreland just looked the part. I think that, well, first off, I thought we never should have been there when I arrived. I arrived feeling that. As time went on and I was reading, it was clear that there didn't really seem to be a commitment by our leadership. It's hard now to distinguish how much I learned later and how much I learned from reading at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But we felt we weren't being given the equipment or the commitment to allow us to win, if that were indeed possible. But, we were always short of material. I didn't have a set of jungle fatigues for the first 5 months I was there.
Mm.
I wasn't sure, but I looked at a photograph of myself a while ago, and I knew what month it was, and I'm still there in those heavy cotton fatigues. So we didn't think we were getting the logistical support that we needed, and we didn't really see a commitment on our leadership, political, and that then translates to what the military can do. A desire to win rather than to just let the Soviets know that we can't be pushed around.
Yeah. Oftentimes we hear, or I hear Vietnam veterans talk about rules of engagement.
Oh, yeah.
Do you care to talk about that?
Again, secondhand, but I
sure.
would have, I roomed at one point with the battalion commander's crew chief. So, and I had roomed with a number of crew chiefs. And their complaint repeatedly was that, we would come under fire and we would radio in for permission to return fire, and we'd been told, you can't, that's a friendly village. At which point our reaction was, how can it be friendly if they're shooting at me? There was great admiration and, I'm missing the word, but we wanted to be like the South Koreans, who were a take no prisoners, don't mess with us boys unless you're ready for it, because they didn't treat anything that shot at them as friendly.
Mm-hmm. Certainly a common refrain that you hear, especially with the war. Well, as you're winding down your time there,
mm-hmm.
What did you think about the progress of the war? You went with some very serious doubts. You've been there for a year with the 1st
yeah.
Division in the Iron Triangle, and you've seen a year's worth of stuff.
Well, I followed an absolutely perfect bell curve on that. I arrived anti-war, certainly not the kind of anti-war that is speaking up or making life difficult for anybody. Somewhere after about 3 or 4 months, I got so carried up in the mission of this aviation unit and so proud of it, I actually started to lose that and just, I lost sight, and I just was caught up in the tactical picture. Then somewhere after about 6-7 months, it occurred to me that we were going back to the same areas and losing people in the same places we were told we pacified earlier, and the reason was we never took in held ground. And so I started swinging back the other way. If we're not serious about this, we shouldn't be sending people out there to give their lives.
And the bell curve that you describe makes perfect sense. I mean, once you've been there with these people and you see what effort is going on, how hard these people are working and the sacrifice is taking place, and you see the ground or the war on the ground firsthand,
mm-hmm.
That's some very powerful visceral images that come out of that are bound to influence who
I'd
you are.
Gone out once had catched on a Sunday my way into flying with the one of our aviation companies that was doing I don't know what operation it was. This is the 25th out of Koo Chi, and they were working all the way to the Cambodian border. And I had wanted, and we were doing a number of things. We were taking sling loads of 105 rounds out. But we were also taking fresh troops out, picking troops up in the field. These are in Chinooks, so you could literally take a platoon in one of those. I had a camera along with me. I was taking lots of photographs. So I would have, real war photographs when I came home. I wanted to take a picture of these guys that we were extracting from the field, who were filthy, in rags, and had the 1,000-yard stare. I couldn't bring myself to do it because I felt like I would be invading their privacy. They just looked so worn out.
And that's after a year.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or less in some cases.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, Vic, your year is drawing to a close here.
Mm-hmm.
We're in December of 67, getting into, I guess, close to January 68. Take me through your last days there in Vietnam.
Well, my last days, I said, I spent my last days at the swimming pool. I oddly felt somewhat guilty about leaving before the job was done and leaving friends who were staying on longer than I was. And then I realized I'd never seen anybody going home volunteer to stay longer so he could be me. So I figured,
sure,
you know, get over that. I do remember very distinctly when I was on the plane home, the guy in the seat next to me was a young fellow about my age with a first division patch on E6 stripes and a Distinguished Service Cross ribbon. And this guy, for the however 18 hours, whatever, all together we had sitting next to each other, never looked left or right, you know, never made any attempt to engage me in conversation. I tried once or twice with him, and all I could think of, seeing that Distinguished Service Cross was, and this, you know, promotion to E6 was, what must your year have been like?
Yeah.
Then I got home, had a very nice leave. As I said, I went up to OPU to get an offer to see if I could get my orders changed from Fort Riley, Kansas. Was given a choice of units or assignments. One was at Fort Monroe, which is the headquarters for Continental Army Command, and was a small public information detachment. I chose that one. They said, go down to Fort Eustis, take this authentication, have them actually print up the mimeographed orders. I went to Fort Eustis, was sent into a room to meet the personnel lieutenant there, and it's a guy I went to school with. He was a swimming partner, my debate partner, best friend. Well, we always knew him as Tree, and so I said, Tree! I mean, Lieutenant Tree, you know, how are you? And you know, then this awkward position. Here's a guy, you know, who I knew as a guy my age, but suddenly he's an officer. So you know, but yet, and I want to acknowledge that we knew one another. And the unit I got sent to at Fort Monroe, I had a very lovely experience there. The unit was called the 38th Public Information Detachment. Its job was to cover a core Army area or bigger for public relations. The TO&E called for a lieutenant colonel, a major, an E8, an E7. We had, as our company commander, one of these two lieutenants just back from the 25th Infantry, who had just been promoted captain. His XO was a 25th Infantry Division platoon leader who would shortly be promoted to captain. We had an E6, was our highest ranking NCO, who was our supply sergeant, also back from the 25th, and I was the only other NCO, also freshly back. So they couldn't send us out of country because, you know, you were supposed to have a period off. So basically we were a unit without a function that we could fulfill. And so my last 5 months of the in the Army consist of coming in the morning, typing up the morning report, going through the mail to see what new regs had to be filed, brewing a pot of coffee, and then three of the officers and I would sit down. We'd play bridge till 5 o'clock.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, welcome home, Vic.
Yeah, right. So there's a complete symmetry in the arc there.
How about that?
It was a very nice assignment. Fort Monroe's beautiful. Part of it is a Civil War era star fort. Very nice grounds, and obviously a very unchallenging final assignment.
Yeah. You get back, I guess it's what, January of 68, correct?
Yep.
And at the end
actually, December 31st, I flew out. I remember because when we landed in San Francisco, it was just past midnight, and I thought, oh, great, you've just had 36 hours of New Year's Eve, and now the bars are closed.
Yeah, that really stinks.
Yeah.
Probably could have used a drink by the time you got off the plane. Here in early 68, of course, end of January, into February of 68, we have the infamous Tet Offensive of that year. this is different from what you've seen in the year that you were there. Can you tell me what you knew about, what you heard about and thought about the Tet Offensive of 68?
Well, I read about it in the papers and then subsequently heard all about it from Don. And, of course, immediately before this, we had Kaysan.
Mm-hmm.
And I read about that avidly. So I'm reading about, you know, all this. It's clearly night and day from what we were aware of. But I'm like anybody else. I'm following it in the newspaper.
Mm-hmm. What was the coverage saying?
Well, the coverage, you know, is, again, it's hard to distinguish what I was hearing then and what I remember since, but the general tone, as I recall it, was that the U.S. Was caught completely by surprise, but in the ensuing 4 to 6 weeks, what initially had appeared to be a Viet Cong North Vietnamese victory, although it appeared to be a public relations victory, was a military defeat. You know, the Viet Cong ceased to be a functional entity, and North Vietnam had to send more and more regulars in to carry the task.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you know, this is at this point, I'm just watching the television. I do watch it avidly. I keep, you know, looking because I still felt very connected with it. I was wondering what was happening to, you know, guys I knew in my unit.
You spend what, 5 more months in the Army at this point?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I went in on June 24th, 66, and I was out on June 24th, 68.
What did you hope to do after your stint in the Army? You have a degree. You
well,
have
that's,
2 years in the Army.
You know, before I went in, I had interviewed with IBM. I had a job offer from them. They told me to be there when I got back. So about 2 months before I was due to get out, I contacted them. And they said, oh, we're really sorry, but all the records you're referring to were destroyed in a warehouse fire in Patterson. Said, but, you know, come on up, and you can go through the same 2 days of testings and interviews, and if they, you know, they're good, you're good. Well, I was really annoyed that this was their reaction. One of the four officers we had in the unit was a fellow by the name of Bill Rogers. He was a reserve lieutenant just doing his 6 or 4 months of active duty. And Bill had gone through a post-college training period with the Equitable Life Insurance Company. They had a program that lasted 9 months. And he sold this to our company commander, Dick Steinhausen, as to me, as well worth a look. So I applied to them and got into that program. And I was just really ticked with IBM. I wasn't sure I wanted to go back and spend 2 days with them.
Well, it's too bad they weren't a giant computer company that could have had that in a database somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a few years away.
Right, right.
Okay. So that's what I wound up doing. I wound up going to work for an insurance company.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the war? It's still going on, and I mm-hmm. know that you don't put this behind you.
No.
You're still paying a lot of attention. It's going to lead to another aspect of your Vietnam experience.
I'm paying
a lot
of attention to it. The year that I was training with the Equitable out in Fort Wayne, Indiana, I literally put it behind me. I just wanted it not to be there. I'm not sure whether I mentioned my ex-wife had saved all the letters that I'd written her when I was in Vietnam. When I found them, and they were in 2 shoeboxes in our closet in our tiny little apartment, I somehow convinced myself and then convinced her that we didn't have the physical space and demanded that they be thrown out, which she did. I found out after we divorced, and she sent them to me, that she'd saved a few of her favorites. But I literally, you know, once I started to work, I was back in the world. And I didn't want to visit that at all. And I remained that way until the invasion of Cambodia and Kent State,
mm-hmm.
at which point I became re-involved, but this time from an avid anti-war standpoint. I joined a group called Vietnam Veterans Against the War. I went in April of 71 to Washington, turned my decorations in, sat in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee when John Kerry made his famous speech. But for a couple of years there, from about 1969 through 70, I just tried to disappear it entirely.
What accounts for the transformation?
Anger that, you know, seeing the invasion of Cambodia, Kent State's going on, you know, clearly we're continuing at this thing that is going nowhere but downwards fast, and people are continuing to die. My ex-brother-in-law, who I loved and who I'm still very close to, at that point was the last forward artillery observer at the top of Nui Ba Den, the volcanic mountain out in the Iron Triangle, which was completely surrounded. And he wound up at Fuloy, and we were in correspondence. I'm thinking, you know, here's Tom on the same ground that I was on 4 years earlier, and it's only getting worse. So when I returned my decorations, I returned them in his honor.
So all these years of just going nowhere with the war, it finally spills over there in 1970. Of course, Kent State was sure, obviously related and as big a part of this, but different circumstances that of course led to it. Do you think that you were on both ends of it? You were in the war and then you came back, as were the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. Do you think that most folks in the U.S. and perhaps most war protesters, active protesters, mm-hmm. were aware enough of what was going on?
I think a small group were. The others, it kind of reminds me like when we had this bath of self-righteousness after 9/11, and we've got troops in Iraq and then later Afghanistan, and people are declaring themselves patriots by putting a metallic blue magnetized yellow ribbon on the side of their car and thinking that they've given their all for their country. No, I think a large part of the population was only, if you weren't directly involved or you weren't a particularly aware or sensitive person, I think a lot of it was just, my wife went through college 4 years later than I did, and I sometimes see the stuff she and her friends were doing, and anti-war was sort of like, I don't know, a social thing that college students did, but I didn't see real commitment in what they were doing.
Yeah. And tell me about the people who you were involved with in the anti-war movement. Who were these folks?
Well, what had happened was, after we invaded Cambodia, I'd written a letter to the White House. I'm sure there's an FBI file on me somewhere. And I heard a guy interviewed on the New Brunswick radio station. They had a talk program at night. And it usually, one of the guests would usually be this local DFW commander who would, you know, just, it was just knee-jerk patriotism. And one night I heard a guy who was a graduate student at Rutgers who'd been with the 101st Airborne, and he's telling a very different story. So when it's phone-in time, I called in. I said, well, you know, I spent some time there, and I really think that that Ken Burnett knows what he's talking about this war, and your VFW guy is just giving you knee-jerk pablum. And I wound up getting connected with the Rutgers University VBAW chapter as a result of that phone call.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about belonging to the chapter. How was it organized? Who was in charge, so to speak? What were, I assume there were committees working
very
together?
Very loosely, there were some national people and regional people who were aware, and they periodically, you know, you'd get contacted, you know, we're going to march in the Veterans Day Parade in Jersey City or something, or once they did something where they actually did a march from northern New Jersey doing political theater along the way and wound up at Washington Square Park in Pennsylvania. And I remember we went, I couldn't get the time away from work for that, but I did on that weekend go down there and join them. You know, there was a newsletter, in my estimation, poorly written and edited. I'm a newsletter editor for a historical society. And, you know, some of it was spot on, some of it was equally knee-jerk, anti-war, you know, no better thought through than the VFW commander's line of reasoning.
What other sorts of activities would be involved with this chapter? Anything else you all had going on, or was it?
No, that was just the newsletters. You know, I got to know the members at Rutgers, and we became, you know, social friends.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that was about it.
Yeah.
And bit by bit, it started pulling in other concerns.
Such as
what? I
wasn't
sure that I endorsed. For example, there were some dedicated communists in it who wanted to, rightly or wrongly, thought that we get involved in wars because of a capitalist system. And I'm going, you know, possibly you're right, but I think the more you layer things on, the less likely you're going to find support.
Mm-hmm.
And so eventually, I guess after, certainly and then in 1973, I went to graduate school and then lost all, went to Philadelphia and lost all contact with it.
Mm-hmm. Well, what you're saying is certainly not unusual. It was the Vietnam War tended to be, were seen as kind of a catalyst of sorts, but a lot of other movements were taking place at the same time, whether it's a social justice thing or a civil rights thing or a women's movement thing or whatever it might be. And they, the more things, like you say, that piled on, or it seems like it more, it fractured things with the, you know, the Black Power, Black Panther movement. You've got, you know, the Weather Underground and these kinds of things, you know, all fellow travelers to a degree,
mm-hmm.
but then kind of splintering off as those things will
do. It's kind of funny. My ex-wife and Fred's wife used to, you know, support us in what they did. They also were becoming about feminists and tried to get that message in the stuff. And, you know, our vision of what a woman with this was sort of like the an American Legion women's auxiliary. You know, you're supposed to be there to support us. You know, we don't want to hear about any of these these other concerns.
Right. Pay attention to me, not to you.
Right, exactly.
Right. Let's not forget why we're doing this, ladies.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you mentioned 73, and of course, 73 is the year that the POWs come home, that the United States withdraws its combat forces, although the war is going to drag on for another 2 years.
2 years, right.
Tell me about the decision of the U.S. to withdraw from Vietnam.
Well, in one way it was a bug out, because regardless of what we said, it was clear once our forces were out, the level of support was going to tumble drastically. I didn't feel that badly about it because I frankly felt it was an unwinnable war, that it was, you could argue both sides very convincingly. Was North Vietnam communist? Yes. Was the Viet Cong communist? Yes. Were there people in South Vietnam who did not want to live this way? Yes. A million of them came from the North. At the same time, it was largely a political argument being waged in a country that had been a country for over 1,000 years, who saw us just as the latest European invader, to also be added to the Japanese and the Chinese. I didn't think it was ever winnable, because I couldn't see the, as I said, we couldn't see the commitment from their own military to win it. I'm sort of off on a tangent here.
No, that's okay.
The question was, but I, you know, I wasn't surprised when 1975 happened. I wasn't terribly upset by it.
You mentioned that you were married, of course, and this first marriage did go south on you.
Mm-hmm.
Did you attribute that at all to your Vietnam experiences?
I think it's altogether possible that it had something to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
My ex-brother-in-law, who saw much more combat than I did, said it ruined his first marriage. He came back, and his father had been, his grandfather's retired policeman, and he got his service revolver and slept with it under his pillow at night.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I don't think that's the only reason that the first marriage ended in divorce, but it certainly was an impact. My ex-wife told me that when I walked in the door to the lobby of our apartment, where she was waiting with my daughter and friends were waiting there, I thought I looked happy and relieved. She said, "You looked dark and angry." I looked dark because, you know, it was January and I had a tan. But
sure.
Said, "You were a frightening-looking person when you walked through that door."
Maybe different kinds of dark, I guess.
Yeah.
And not just in the skin tone in this case. What do you think there was about that could have impacted someone's marriage, whether it was your brother-in-law's or whether it was yours? What is it about the experience that could lend itself to this being a contributing factor to the demise of a marriage?
Well, you certainly, on certain issues, become a lot less communicative. I did not, after that, like crowds. If we were shopping or something, there were too many people around, I would get fidgety. And I attributed that to, when you're training in the infantry, it's always, where is the escape route?
Mm-hmm.
And so, I think we're much, much more difficult people to live with. I have to say, once I met the guys from Rutgers, who, they're now in undergraduate school or graduate school in 1969-70, I got introduced to the world of recreational drugs.
Is that right? That's something you care to talk about?
Well, just used nothing more than marijuana and some hash. Nothing, never any opioids.
Mm-hmm.
But, it was a different world.
Yeah.
Than the stuff that I'd never seen when I was overseas. And it was an escape, I used it as an escape.
Well, give me a brief kind of thumbnail sketch of the rest of your career and the other important events in your life.
Sure. Well, I mentioned I was in graduate school. I had started to work with that insurance company. It was in an administrative position. As I got further into it after a couple of years, I started getting bored. I thought the kinds of people that administration attracted and retained were not very interesting what's the word I want? Inquisitive, willing to take risks, and I was shopping around for something to do. My ex-wife also was shopping around for a way to start becoming active out of the house, and she had successfully entered a PhD program in clinical psychology at Temple University. We had a couple of friends who were psychotherapists, and they seemed to be having a wonderful life. So I took some night classes after work at Rutgers' as I went through, we had moved down to Pennsylvania, just northeast of Philadelphia, so she could commute to school. And I wound up going into the same program, got a complete NIMH grant, full tuition from the university. And I realized when that lined up that I was knocking myself out in something I didn't like for $16,500 a year to support three people, four people at that point, that I could live just about as well between that money and the GI Bill money and try something else.
Sure.
So I did. And after a couple of years, both the university and I concluded that although I was a bright guy who was very good with statistics and experimental design, I wasn't Mr. Roger, I had the wrong temperament to be a psychotherapist. I came from a long line of medical doctors and engineers. As far as I was concerned, if you gave me a problem to solve, I would look at it, tell you what the solution was, and then tell you, okay, implement it, and don't come back until you have. So then when, so at that point, when I left the program, I've had a background in the insurance industry. I have a background in academia and a lot of experimental design, that kind of thing. I left with a master's in 60 hours towards my doctorate. And I got hired by the American College in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, which was a distance learning facility for the insurance industry. They granted the CLU designation and some other things. And so it seemed to be a perfect marriage of the two things. And I ran a distance learning program where CLU chapter members taught our courses. And that all hung together until the advent of computer-administered exams, at which point, because before that, you held a class for 4 months, you had two of them, and then it was time. The national exams were all given on the same day everywhere in the country. When computer exams came up, that program started to fall apart. I had decided, I was task force with a couple other younger members by a new president of the college who had brought in McKinsey. And so I spent some time working with the McKinsey team on documenting the way we did business and how we could improve. And had started an MBA program at night. And when it was all done, the president said, "What would you like to do?" I said, "I'd like to get into marketing for this institution." So for years, represented it and its programs to about 20 different companies. And then eventually, because it was an academic institution still, we had gotten accreditation, there really was no path beyond that without a terminal degree. So I went out and applied to the New York Life Insurance Company to run the marketing of their annuity business, got that job. And really, the rest of my life, academically or professionally rather, was either in strictly marketing, strictly market research, or some combination of the two, mostly for insurance companies, briefly with a Big Five accounting firm and with the insurance arm of a British bank. And one of the things I felt I learned along the way was that narrow definitions of what things are limiting. When I was a marketer, I considered myself a research-oriented marketer. As a researcher, I considered myself a marketing-sensitive researcher. I found that nothing I had learned, including how to write well at William & Mary and put together an inquiry and put together an analysis, nothing I ever learned has done anything but stood me well. And I just tried to use as much of it as I could, regardless of what the particular position, was called. Mm-hmm. And that's about it. At 66, I retired. I continued continue to cycle actively. I'm active with our historical society, where I'm the curator of collections and the newsletter editor. I'm active with a committee to the township government called the Historic Preservation Advisory Board, and play a little guitar on the side.
Hmm. And of course, remarried.
And remarried. Remarried a wonderful woman who I'd worked with at the American College, and then she moved on. And after I'd been divorced and I'd gone with some friends who were single or pretending to be single to the bar scene for a while, I thought this was hideous. And they said, well, what about Maureen? Did you ever consider dating her? So I called her up once, and she decided to have fun with me. She pretended she knew nothing about the divorce and so wanted to know why I, a married man, was calling her for a date. And so it made me swing for a bit before she let on that, oh, she knew all about it. She'd stayed in touch with all the people. And an extremely bright woman. She has a Douglas College undergraduate in MLS from Rutgers, and later, while she was at Drexel, where her ex-husband, not ex at that time, was pursuing a PhD, she took an MBA at Drexel.
Hmm.
And we do all this stuff except the guitar and the bicycle together. Oh, we're also active with a regional chapter of people who own first-generation Corvettes.
Oh, you're one of those people.
Yeah, I'm one of those people. I got my first one when I was 50 years old. I just put the last one of my children through college and then a graduate study. And while she was away on vacation, I found the one I want. And she was so secured, or not, she was away on a business trip, rather, secured. Took it, all this happened while she was away, and she was sure I had done that laying in wait for her to be away. Subsequently, she got involved with it and is actually more involved with it than I am.
Oh, is that right? Well, I've only got a few more questions for you, Vic. One is, you know, I'm kind of interested. What do you read anything Vietnam related anymore? Do you watch any Vietnam?
Yes, I
movies.
Do. I read books where I think it's someone. I've read a number of books by people who are involved in either the infantry or aviation. So I do. One of the things I learned when I was with VBAW, I mean, I came back in 1968, having served in a particular place at a particular point in time with a particular type of unit, and I thought I knew everything about Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I started running into people. I'll never forget one day we were doing a protest thing, so we're wearing our old fatigues, and there's a guy there with Air Force fatigues on. I said, what was your MOS? What'd you do there? And he said, well, I was a combat weatherman. I thought, oh, this is rich. I said, tell me what a combat weatherman did. He said, well, they would chopper us across the DMZ about 30 or 40 kilometers, put us in there, and we'd sit there with a radio to radio weather conditions into the route packs flying in to bomb North Vietnam. But, oh, so you were a real warrior. And, boy, there are a whole lot of things that were going on that I was entirely unaware of.
Right.
And I ran into another guy who was with the Navy, with the Riverine Force, so I discovered, that I knew in detail a lot about a very small area at a specific point in time. And I guess a lot of the reading has been either to confirm what I thought about units I knew there, or to learn about things that I simply didn't know about.
Mm-hmm. What about movies? Do you watch any Vietnam-related movies?
I have, I recommended that one called The Odd Angry Shot.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are a couple of superb ones. Platoon. I was flying with the 25th, flying the 25th Infantry at the same time the author of Platoon, his name escapes me at the moment, was serving there. For all I know, I flew him on a mission, you know.
Oliver Stone, I believe.
Yeah, Oliver Stone. Yeah, maybe Ollie Stone was one of those people. I don't know. It was the right time, in the right place. And so I think there are a couple of good movies. There's an awful lot of trash out there, like Full Metal Jacket, the Deer Hunter, the notion that an E6 could fly anywhere in the country to look for his best friend is just pure nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's about it. I would recommend highly to anyone who wants to see it. PBS did something called Dear America.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, which I think that and something they also did called Vietnam War Story are two of the better things that have ever been done about it.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned those a couple of movies there, and one in particular, The Deer Hunter. It's kind of in our national consciousness, even if we're not familiar with it or really aware of it. It's kind of wormed its way into, along with a number of other Vietnam War-related kind of movies of the genre, into what Vietnam veterans are or who they were.
Yeah.
So it leads me to ask you, what do you think about the way the Vietnam veteran has been portrayed over the years in American society and American culture? And it changes throughout the years as well. So what's your opinion of that?
Well, a lot of it was not very good. I mean, you were sort of presented as this group of crazies, drug-addled crazies who were child murderers. Interestingly, I read years later that there was a prejudice against hiring Civil War veterans at the end of the Civil War because they had what was known as soldier's disease, and that was because that war was the first time that opiates were used. And apparently a number of Civil War veterans were opiate addicted, and so they were, there's a distrust about hiring them. My experience, there's an awful lot of stuff, I think, that's out there that was wishful thinking. For example, I had heard the stories when I was there of prisoners being taken up in a UE and, interrogated and thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
I have talked to countless crew chiefs, and when I heard about them, talked to some then. Everybody knew this story. Nobody had ever done it,
mm-hmm.
or knew someone who did it. I think what it was reflecting the degree of frustration we felt about the limits put on what we could do. And so it was a fantasy. There might have been an example of that somewhere, but a lot of the stuff that got talked about and propounded, I think, was fantastical. In my personal experience, where I experienced it was that I think I got coarsened to the degree that when I first got there, for referring to somebody as a gook or a dink or a slope, I found offensive. Long before that year was up, I was using all those terms.
Mm-hmm.
Never treating anybody badly, but falling into a lot of this not good behavior, at least mentally.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think by and large, there have not been a lot of very accurate appraisals. I thought the young guy, the Sheehan character in Platoon is very believable, very whereas the two sergeants are, they're great fictional characters.
Mm-hmm. In place there basically is kind of the archetype and the
oh, you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of what's right and what's wrong.
The white and the black, and the yin and the yang.
Yeah.
And just like, what is the name of it? The great one is nothing but Heart of Darkness,
mm-hmm. Right. Well, just a couple more questions for you, Vic, and we can wrap it up. Looking back on your year in Vietnam and everything that meant, which includes your time on Capitol Hill in 71 and all of your activities and all of this, but looking back on that year and everything Vietnam meant to you, how do you think it most influenced your life? How did it most affect you?
Well, it's certainly, I've learned to distrust what I hear from my government a great deal more. I would be where I still think, you know, we have to have a military. I have a lot of respect for people who choose to make it a career. I think we have to be, I would be very, very slow to say, all right, send the boys and girls. It's now boys and girls now, because the way we were lied to in Iraq, the way we were lied to in Vietnam with a, you know, a destroyer that was never fired upon. It's made me much more cautious. It's made me aware that, you know, every one of them we're sending is somebody's son or wife or daughter or husband, you know. It's made me much slower to wave, to rattle the sword.
Finally, a very broad question. But I'd like to ask it of folks who were there. You know, the Vietnam War has been a political football in a lot of ways. Well, this is what it was, this is what it was, this is what it meant, this is what it means, these are the lessons, all of that. And we can, I mean, that's, you know, ad nauseum, continue to discuss that. But let me ask you, since you were there, a thoughtful human being, when we look back at it, what do you think will be the lasting legacy of the Vietnam War? And that's a monstrously huge question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Well, I would hope that one would be caution in about engaging in armed conflict, making really sure you know what's going on, and probably the biggest one is have an end game. And the end game has to make sense. You have to go in because your national interests are deeply involved and potentially compromised, and you have to know how you're going to pursue it and where do you declare victory and get out. We've had, you know, just far too many of these things, well, starting with Vietnam, but, you know, then we had Iraq, where that wasn't done. I think increasingly that it's been recognized that it was a major mistake. Now, I know some people. I know a couple of infantry veterans. There's one guy who's been trying to get me to tour with him visiting high schools because he thinks there's a lesson for them. But when I listen to him, this is a clinically depressed individual who really has no particular message. But it's still just reliving this. And I know some people who have lost brothers or sons, and it's, I can understand why someone may wish not to confront the fact that their brother, in case of one person, or their son died for what in retrospect was a misadventure. You know, I can understand that it hurts someone so that deeply. But that doesn't then mean that it was something that should have been pursued.
Sure.
So I'm proud of the caliber of the service I rendered. I did my very best. I took some personal risks. I'm justifiably proud of them. I actually have all my medals back because a couple of years ago I went to get my New Jersey driver's license. And the copy of I had a DD-214, which when I first got home, and it was in Fort Wayne, Indiana, they were doing something at City Hall, and they convinced me that it was a very valuable document, that for its safety, they should make a copy of it with a seal, give it to me, and keep the original one on record there. Well, when I went to get the license, a very nice woman there said, first, I want to thank you for your service, but second, this is not an acceptable document. So I wrote whatever address you write with the federal government to get a replacement DD-214. Apparently the request was misunderstood because about 8 weeks later, a box full of medals arrived.
Is that right?
Yeah, every one I'd ever had, including my sharpshooter badge.
I'll be darned.
And then I went back and requested again and got a correct replacement DD-214. Mm-hmm. But I actually wound up getting all the medals back, and enough distance has come and gone that I asked my wife to have a professionally done shadow box made with them.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, good. I'm glad that that you kind of looked at this in a different light.
Yeah, what I did in 1971 was out of sheer frustration with a government that seemed to not pay us any attention and kept insisting that all those who opposed the war were obviously either commies or cowards, and a group of us just came forward and said, no, they're those of us who served well, did exactly what you asked us to do, and we think it's wrong, and we want to put the lie to this that everybody who is involved supports it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Vic, is there anything else that you'd like to add before we close out the interview?
No, I'd say everybody likes talking about themselves, and this has been a lot of fun.
Well, good. That's my business.
You do it very well.
Thanks. All right. Well, this will end the interview with Vic Berry. Okay. This is still the 1st of April in 2016 with Vic Berry. He came up with another story about 30 seconds after we ended the first recording. So let's go ahead and pick up that story.
Okay.
Vic.
Yeah. Never tire of talking about myself. when I went through in induction, they gave you a number of tests. They gave me a language aptitude test and told me I'd done very highly on it, and that if I'd like to extend my service from 2 years to 4 years, they'd send me to the Army Language School in Monterey. They also said, do you speak another language? And I said, yes, I speak French. And they gave me a French test. Well, you know, this is induction. You know, they're collecting this information for their purposes, not yours. So I never heard anything further about it. After I'd been with the 11th for about 4 months or so, we had a French Canuck in our unit who I worked with, Paul Viancourt. And one day he gets notified that he's on 24-hour notice, 12-hour notice, have your gear packed, and be ready to go. And Paul disappears. That's the last we hear of him, but the rumor mill starts generating information that Paul is now living in a hotel in Bangkok.
Hmm.
Gee, this is pretty good. You know? So I went and saw the personnel officer and said, you know, I took a French fluency test when I entered the Army. I never heard anything further. So he looked at my records and said, yeah, hey, Army considers you French fluent. So I said, well, would you have that language designator put on my MOS? He said, certainly. Well, the call never comes for me. And about 4 months after that, I get a postcard from Paul, who's now out of the Army. And it says, I guess you wondered where I've been. Well, I've been in Laos flying with Air America, but since we're not there, I wasn't allowed to tell anybody. But now that I'm out of the Army, I don't care, I'm telling you. And I thought, thank God the call never came.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Wow.
Because I figured, you know, if I died in Vietnam, my family would be told. But if you died there, nobody was ever going to know anything.
Yeah. Well, that is really interesting. It's all about timing, Vic.
It sure is.